Well, they're going to be ramped up somewhat today because Shabana Mahmood, the relatively new Home Secretary, is considering, I think probably more than considering, even further restrictions on what you can and can't do by way of protest. And she introduces a new phrase, I think, to the discourse. The phrase is cumulative impact. Similar demonstrations happening in the same place on a regular basis, building up, well, unhappiness to the point where Shabana Mahmood may close them down.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, negotiators from Israel and Hamas are preparing to hold talks in Egypt about ending the war in Gaza. The latest diplomatic efforts come after Hamas agreed to parts of a peace plan put forward by President Trump. He's urged those involved to move fast, warning that bloodshed will follow if a deal isn't agreed. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has echoed the president's call for urgency while speaking to the broadcaster ABC.
We're hoping it'll be finalized very quickly, early this week. And I'm hoping, you know, again, who knows the timeline, but this cannot take weeks or even multiple days. We want to see this happen very fast. If it doesn't, then I think the entire deal becomes imperiled. So this has to happen quickly.
The Shadow Chancellor will promise to save £47 billion of taxpayers' money if the Conservatives win the next general election. Samuel Stride is due to address the party's conference in Manchester shortly. He's expected to outline plans to cut spending on welfare and social housing. The government is proposing to cut costs for people buying property as part of major reforms to the home buying system. Changes include asking sellers for more information up front so buyers don't need to pay for searches and surveys. The shake-up aims to cut costs, reduce delays and halve failed sales. France's new Prime Minister has resigned less than a month after being appointed. Sébastien Lecornu had been facing the threat of a vote of no confidence by rival parties. The Rugby World Cup winner Lewis Moody has revealed he'd been diagnosed with motor neurone disease. The former England captain says the news has been a huge shock but is focused on staying positive. MND affects nerves found in the brain and spinal cord, affecting the ability to move and talk. Tanya Curry is from the Motor Neurone Disease Association and has told LBC the causes are still not fully understood.
Some studies have shown a link between head injuries and contact sports with neurological diseases, but we don't know enough to say that's an absolute correlation. The scientists think there is some kind of combination between environmental, lifestyle and genetic factors, but we can't actually say, yes, it's that sport that causes this disease. But we also recognise we are seeing sportsmen coming through with these injuries.
Around 8,500 homes are facing a fourth day without power in Scotland after Storm Amy hit. Scottish and Southern electricity networks say engineers are working to restore supplies. In this city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 16 at 94.47. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 15. LBC weather cloudy, but dry for most today. Rain in northern areas, some sunny spells developing in the southeast with highs of 19 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
How would you describe McCain vibes?
I would reckon it's like a crisp and a chip. If they had a baby, do you know what I mean? Well, you know what?
A chip and a crisp.
Combination.
It's got crisp ancestry, but it's a chip.
Like a hot chip crisp combo thingy? Yeah? Pure poetry, that was.
McCain vibes. Our chip crisp combo hot snack thingies. In a freezer aisle near you.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning, it's 3 minutes after ten. Here's a little question for you to kick the week off. How effective is peaceful public protest? Seriously, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you, that question only just popped into my head literally 6 seconds ago, so I haven't spent an awful lot of time trying to come up with examples of when it has been effective. But when we speak about public protest having the desired result, we reach often for the poll tax. But that was not peaceful. I mean, they were very sort of impassioned and I think violent. I'm much younger than I would need to speak with full confidence about what happened there in the sort of dog days of Margaret Thatcher's premiership. But it wasn't peaceful protest. I mean, you might think of Mahatma Gandhi, of course, when it comes to the power of peaceful protest. But I'm thinking chiefly of this country. I'm thinking chiefly of the United Kingdom. And I don't want to sound like a wazzock. And as I get older, I'm more conscious of how wazzicky some contributions to conversations may have sounded in my younger days. Yeah, protest is good. And we have been conditioned in this country to be suspicious of it. Did Swampy succeed? I guess another age-based inquiry. If you're of a certain age, you will remember there was a campaigner during a road-building exercise who sort of dug himself into a tunnel and refused to come out because the road-building exercise was going to destroy ancient woodland. And he was a fascinating character because the traditional corners of the right-wing media tried very, very hard to portray him as a weirdo, or bearded weirdo. And actually, he gathered quite a lot of public support and affection. I don't know whether it was down to him or whether it was because he was simply the focus for broader movements. But that's an example of peaceful protest that I think of. Except I think he was also breaking the law, even though he was simply sitting in a hole. There comes a point where if you have been ordered by the authorities to move, then most obviously you're trespassing when you say no. Just Stop Oil, a noble cause. If you believe in science, obviously, a very annoying bunch of people if you don't believe in science. And that's not even funny anymore. If I'd said that 5 years ago, it would have been with my tongue in my cheek. But you've got the most powerful administration on the planet now demonstrating daily that it does not believe in science. Or it is so desperate to please the plutocrats that it will pretend not to believe the science while enacting legislation and pursuing policies that are in complete opposition to the observable scientific evidence. Swampy, what did I call him? Did I get his name wrong? What did I call him? There wasn't also, or maybe you're sending me the word Swampy in order to suggest things that have worked. Suffragettes or suffragists? I'm afraid I get them mixed up. One was legal, one was not. That was not peaceful protest. At times, even if the sacrifices made were of themselves, you think of the lady who threw herself under the hooves of a horse at the Derby and the chaining to railings, but it could end in force feeding, it could end in hose pipes being shoved down women's throats because they were on hunger strike. That's peaceful protest from the protester's point of view, but it's not very peaceful from the authorities' point of view. So actually, I'll do that. I'm getting some nice messages through, but I'll put that on the board. You can ring in with that if you want, the effectiveness of peaceful protest. Because the reason I used the word wazzock a moment ago is because I think it's probably linked partly to guilt or shame. I'm obsessed, or not obsessed, but fascinated by how much of what we are, how much of the bad bits of us are down to guilt and shame. It's not just because I was raised a Catholic, where they use guilt and shame essentially to control your mind, or at least to try to control your behaviour. But guilt and shame are huge drivers of human behaviour. I think if everybody understood this, or if everybody had a little bit of therapy, we'd be in a much happier place. It could be shame of not having lived up to your parents' expectations can still be driving people to do nasty things in their 60s. Guilt, an incredible driver. You're going to be horrible to someone over there for doing the right thing because you feel guilty about the fact that you can't be bothered. I sometimes think with protests that guilt, a lot of the negativity is driven by guilt and shame. Not if you're the thing being protested against or you're in support of the thing being protested against. I mean, those of us who sit in the middle sometimes. Why can you be so easily persuaded to hate on Just Stop Oil or to hate on Swampy and his mates or to hate on whoever it is that is protesting that? And partly it is either a little bit of guilt that you can't be bothered to do it yourself or a little bit of embarrassment that you don't feel things strongly enough. You sort of wish that your life, your inner life, was a bit richer. God, I wish I cared about something as much as you care about the environment. I wish I cared about something as much as you care about fossil fuels or whatever else it may be. You see it at the football. I wish I cared about issues as much as I care about football. Caring this much about football is just stupid. Why do I care this much about football? Don't know, don't need to know. But if I cared about other human beings, if I cared about the future of the planet, if I cared about appalling acts and appalling behaviours. I cared about other people that I'm never going to meet as much as I care about 22 men kicking a sack of leather around the pitch every Saturday afternoon and losing to Peterborough Sports. Unbelievable inability to hold on. But you see, it's not funny really, is it? Go on, look yourself in the eye, look deep into your own soul. Tell me honestly whether you care more about human beings suffering or planetary crisis than you do about whatever your favourite pointless pursuit may be, whether it's football, video games, chess or rugby league. So that's question number one. How much does it matter? How much does it matter? Peaceful protest. Remind everybody why. Remind me why it really matters. Even if we could sit here and struggle to assemble proof that it really moves mountains. Proof that it turns oil tankers round. Proof that it changes laws and minds and governments. Struggling to do that. So remind us why it matters on 0345 6060 973. But that's not the main question. Civil liberty groups. What's happened to you then, right there, when I said civil liberty groups? Did you curdle a bit? Did you go, oh? Because you, I tell you something for nothing, they have put an awful lot of effort over the course of your lifetime into making you respond to the words civil liberty groups by going, oh. It's a bit like human rights. Oh, God, human rights, eh? Who cares about that? Except humans, I suppose. You see what I mean? Civil liberty. Oh, flipping it. Blooming do-gooders. I bet they eat muesli for every meal. Civil liberties, human rights. Anyway, civil liberty groups expressed concern yesterday over government plans to hand police greater powers to restrict protests. As organisers of mass demonstrations against the banning of Palestine Action pledged a major escalation of their campaign. So here's something else you have to do that's quite tricky. You have to ignore what the protest is about and focus upon the principle of protest instead. You have to ignore what you are most passionate about or most opposed to and focus on the protest. So the law has to apply to the protesters you agree with at least as much as it applies to the protesters you disagree with. You see what I mean? Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, said yesterday that large-scale demonstrations, and she focuses on this specific issue, but that's the point about principles and laws, is that you can't. If you introduce a principle, if you change the law, then it will apply next time to completely different people. But she describes considerable fear among the Jewish community, inevitably, since the synagogue atrocity last week, since the terrorist attack on the synagogue in Manchester last week, but it was in place before that as well. And the idea that protests against the genocide in Gaza or in solidarity with Palestinian people add to that fear, is her rationale for bringing in new powers where police would be able to impose tougher conditions on static protests or marches by taking account of the cumulative impact of previous similar demonstrations. Now, I don't know how that reaches your ears, but it sounds a little bit to me as though if these protests actually start working or succeeding or changing minds or focusing attention upon issues, then Shabana Mahmood is suggesting that's the time when you need to shut them down or move them on. I want to make something absolutely clear. You engage in anti-Semitism, you are a scumbag. If you engage in support for mistreatment of hostages or the terrorist attack of October the 7th, if you conflate Israel with Judaism, then you are a scumbag. And if you're doing it on a march, you should have your collar felt. If you're doing anything in public that constitutes a breach of public order, you should have your collar felt. Full stop, new paragraph, no questions, please. So we're not talking about them. We're not talking about the people that some callers over the couple of years we've been discussing this have told us are on these marches, and some people who are also on the marches tell us they have never seen. Their existence is not moot, but nobody is defending them. Shabana Mahmood is not saying if you carry a banner that appears to show support for Hamas, you're going to get your collar felt. She's saying if you carry nothing at all, but you were there last week and the week before and the week before, then possibly you shouldn't be allowed to be there next week. The police already have powers of arrest on Palestine Action, because they have proscribed it as a terrorist group, which meant that the police had to arrest nearly 500 people at the weekend for the offence of holding a banner that says, I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action. Something I think I may have misrepresented slightly last week, but I heard an interview with Jonathan Porritt, who's a senior member of Defend Our Juries, at the weekend, and he made it pretty clear that these are deliberately and carefully peaceful protests, silent protests, people literally in unison with each other lifting up this placard and sitting down. And the police already have the powers to arrest those people, 500. So, fear number one, it sounds as if what she's worried about is these protests, these silent, peaceful, legal protests working when it comes to public opinion, public feeling regarding what is going on in Gaza. But remember, if they change the law for this, then it will apply to everything else as well. And then the second bit of the conversation is they've made such an almighty mistake by proscribing Palestine Action that they're now going to have to change another law, sacrifice another liberty of yours and mine in order to cover up the embarrassment of having to arrest 500 little old ladies every Sunday because they have somehow ended up being supporters of terrorism under the last law that this government brought in. Or the last piece of legislation that this government brought in. And then think about your road. What if there was a former hotel at the bottom of your street where asylum seekers are currently being accommodated because of the Tories' complete failure to run a even half-decent system and the continuing, albeit that their numbers are plummeting. Labour's attempts to fix the mess they inherited are going to be necessarily slow. What if it was at the end of your street? How would you feel about that every night, every day, every Saturday, every other Tuesday? For flipping heck, I can feel my house price coming down in value every time the flags go up. How would you feel about that? So again, the police have the powers to decide where and when you can protest. But this feels weird, doesn't it? The idea of protesting solidarity with Palestinian people in Gaza, while simultaneously being perfectly capable of condemning Hamas, condemning the vile atrocity of October the 7th, recognizing the anti-Semitic nature of conflating Jewish with Israeli, all of those things. I can hold all of those thoughts in my head at the same time. And if somebody on these protests can't and publicly articulates that, then they are already going to fall foul of the law. You're going to fall foul of the law in this country if you are holding up a placard that says, I support Palestine Action. In fact, you'd have got yourself arrested at the weekend, simply for doing that. I felt on Friday that it would have been thoughtful to curtail the protest this weekend. I listened to Jonathan Porritt describing what the Palestine Action protest actually involves. I think many of us had in our minds the image of marches and rallies and speakers. It's a little bit more nuanced than perhaps we allowed on Friday, but I still personally feel, and it's a very personal position, that they could have taken the day off. They should have taken the day off. But it should have been their choice. And it was. And they chose to go ahead. And I respect that as well as an exercise of civil liberty. So if I say, I don't think you should do that, but I completely respect your right to do it, I'm operating in a democracy where our freedoms are protected. If a Home Secretary says, I don't think you should do that, and you say, well, I'm going to do it anyway because I disagree with you, and she says, oh, well, in that case, I'll see you in jail. I think we've got a problem. I think we've got a problem. I mean, it seems very odd, doesn't it, to talk about prescribing protests after the United Nations has decided that there is a genocide unfolding in Gaza. That would surely be the point at which all of the people who have been calling for the carnage to end should have received an apology from the authorities. No? It's not a rhetorical no, I mean it. I want your thoughts on this. So, civil liberty groups expressed concern yesterday over government plans to hand police greater powers to restrict protests. So, the idea is that if people protest regularly and effectively, and, I mean, it's hard to do the next bit without doing that thing that constitutes anti-Semitism. It's hard to talk about how Jewish people are upset by protests against the Israeli government, because that is suggesting that there is a conflation of Jewish with Israeli, which is categorically not the case. And to suggest so is anti-Semitic. So, remember also that it has to apply to every protest on every subject under the sun, whether you like it or whether you don't like it. So I don't quite get this, to be honest with you. I don't quite understand Shabana Mahmood's logic. It, here are some protests against a genocide, or even simply in solidarity with the victims of a genocide. Here are some people over here who you cannot say support the genocide, but they're really upset about the protests against the genocide. Show me an anti-Semite on this march, and I'll show you someone who should be arrested. Show me a little old lady holding up a placard saying, I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action, and you should get arrested, because that's how the law currently stands. But someone who is not breaking any law, who is protesting entirely peacefully, being told, sorry, you can't do that because you're hurting the feelings of people. Well, what am I doing that's hurting the feelings of people? Tell me. Well, you're protesting against genocide. Well, whose feelings are hurt by that? And how much respect should I have for those feelings? I hope I'm presenting this correctly. If I'm not, you know what to do. 0345 6060 973. I think I am, and I think it's really ugly. I'd love you to tell me why it isn't, why you support this, but remember, we're talking very simply and very straightforwardly about protests that are not, or protesters that are not anti-Semitic. Might be anti-Israel, but that you can't say that person over there who's not anti-Semitic should not be allowed to protest because of the possible existence of that person over there who is. Going to struggle to separate this particular example from the broader picture, but we should try. But how can you say to someone protesting against the genocide that you should stop protesting against the genocide because you're hurting the feelings of somebody over there? I don't quite get that. It doesn't feel very British. It's not a phrase you'll hear me utter very often. But if you think of Enlightenment values, I think you can say it doesn't feel very British, does it? Your thoughts, 0345 6060 973. Should she or shouldn't she, Shabana Mahmood, use something called cumulative impact to allow the police to say, you can't do this, you're not on the list, you're not coming in?
LBC.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Welcome our new bookworms to the club. Now, do you read traditional books or e-books?
Oh, real books.
Traditional, always.
Yes, quite.
I read e-books. Mm-hmm. I adjust it so the font's huge.
Ooh, they make large font books.
Think bigger. Imagine Moby Dick all cuddled up with a book. His font size.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. Maybe it's time for varifocals. At Specsavers, get 2-for-1 varifocal glasses from £110. Conditions and exclusions apply. See online for details.
Hey, it's me, your dishwasher. I'm sorry about the chaos last night. I think a fork got jammed in my racks. Whoops. Don't even check the bills. I've overdone it. Don't get mad, okay, but I used up lots of power yesterday. Sometimes you just have to blow off some steam.
It can feel like all your energy does is take, take, take. But the longer you're with OVO, the more rewards you get. OVO, do energy differently. Beyond customers only, eligibility required, redemption limits apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
On a lighter note, I have a list in front of me of 10 things you don't know about Mel Stride, the Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer. It is currently circulating, deliberately, it's not like a practical joke, around the Conservative Party conference. And I will share these nuggets with you in the course of the programme. But we have rather more important things in front of us. Alarm over ministers' plan to give police more anti-protest powers. It doesn't feel to me that we live currently in a country where the police don't have enough anti-protest power. But then again, I'm not a serial protester. Maybe you are. Maybe I should just shut up and take some calls. Yes, I completely agree. Ben's in Edgware. Ben, what would you like to say?
Hello, yes. Now, this whole thing is crazy. Shabana Mahmood could have stopped that demonstration by lifting the ban, which was an absurd ban, and prescribing of Palestine Action as a terrorist entity. She could have, stopped it by just saying to the police, don't arrest them. I was there. I was trying to convince the police, actually, please, try and be human beings. These people were in a silent protest, a very dignified protest.
Could you tell me exactly what happened in the context of the protest? Because I think I got it a bit wrong on Friday, and I'd love to hear an eyewitness participant account of exactly how the protest itself unfolds.
Well, I was there. I was actually filming it. I've got a whole stack of footage. Yes. On this. The whole principle of the protest, in fact, was a silent vigil. People sitting down, holding placards, saying, I oppose genocide. Horrific daily genocide. I oppose genocide. I support Palestine Action. Now, that was the principle of the vigil. It was not a demonstration. It was not a march. And many Jews were participating, as I'm Jewish myself. And I watched the horrible spectacle of these battalions of police in ranks, sort of marching into the crowd, picking out people, one by one, hauling them up, some really disabled people, elderly people, people in walking sticks, a blind person who this was his third protest. The whole thing was utterly ridiculous. And Shabana Mahmood, the reason there are repeat demonstrations is for Britain to stop participating in the genocide, to stop the arms going to Israel. Britain is a direct participant in the genocide. In fact, they are supporting the terrorism of Israel. Israel has been wreaking terror on the Palestinians since 1948, and this has got to stop. The reason that Hamas had that, it was a terror attack that was horrific. And in fact, a lot of those people killed on that day were killed by the Israeli forces coming in and with Apache helicopters and tanks. And a lot of the people killed were actually killed by Israel.
I'm aware of this, and I'm always conscious of not wanting to jump in too quickly during these conversations, but I am going to steer you back, if I may, to the events of this weekend and the legislative programme in this country. I'm going to struggle. I think everybody's going to struggle to separate the prescription of Palestine Action from what looks like a panicked move from Shabana Mahmood. But can you, for a moment, especially given your own sort of heritage and background, can you understand why some people of the same faith as you are very discomforted by the protest that you've just described?
Yes, I can. I can. I mean, look, having a synagogue attacked is a horrific thing. I go to synagogue. I see the CST, policing the presence. And
this is the community security trust.
I can understand this, but I hate to say this, but a lot of this is orchestrated on behalf of Israel. Because the chief rabbi...
I'm going to steer you back again to sorry, you've got a lot to get off your chest, but I want to know whether or not you have any sympathy for people who say, particularly after the events of last week, the protest you attended this weekend upsets and offends me. Can you get your head around that? This peaceful protest, which makes no claim beyond which the United Nations has already made. Does that bit of it, in your mind, ever constitute cumulative impact?
Yes, of course it does. But, you know, I certainly understand the Jewish people who feel, you know, when they hear chants, you know, of Palestine will be free from the river to the sea, that means it doesn't mean they want to get rid of the state of Israel. It means they want freedom for the Palestinians within that area that used to be Palestine.
Well, again, that is debatable and disputable, but certainly your position probably doesn't get heard as often as the claim that it is a very full-throated call for the eradication of the modern state of Israel. Thank you, Ben. I mean, this idea that if they hadn't proscribed Palestine action, which, remember, the person we turned to first that morning was the guy that used to be head of security at Greenham Common, where there were repeated attempts to interfere with military equipment, and no proscribing, none of the people responsible were ever adjudged to be terrorists. Criminal damage, yes. Criminals, yes, but not terrorists. And that is why they're in such a mess. So, what should Shabana Mahmood do? I suppose you have to either de-proscribe, if that's even a word, Palestine action, or you have to avoid the sight of 500 people. And Maggie's cross with me for saying little old ladies. She points out it's very patronising. Little old men. I'm just trying to paint a picture of somebody who's not a sort of a typical verbally violent or very aggressive protester. This is, and Ben did a good job of that. You know, this is disabled people, blind people, all sorts of people, elderly people, all kinds of people sitting silently together in solidarity with people suffering genocide. And the idea that this should be curtailed, this should be moved on, this should be banned in any way, seems to me to spring almost entirely from the fact that the police can't cope with the consequences of the proscription of Palestine action. I don't know. Your thoughts on this. And feel free to challenge anything that Ben has said as well. 0345-6060973 is the number that you need. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
The Shadow Chancellor has used a keynote speech to claim the Conservatives are the only party that will stand up for fiscal responsibility. Addressing the party's conference in Manchester, Sir Mel Stride has promised to save taxpayers £47 billion if the party wins the next election. Talks between mediators representing Israel and Hamas are taking place in Egypt today. The negotiations will focus on a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages under a plan put forward by President Trump. And the French President Emmanuel Macron is searching for his sixth prime minister since the start of last year. Sébastien Lecornu has resigned ahead of a no-confidence vote, having only taken up the role last month. LBC weather, cloudy but dry for most, rain in northern areas, some sunny spells in the southeast, highs of 19 degrees.
This is LBC.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com. That's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
Private healthcare sounds pricey.
At Benenden Health, it's less than £16 per person per month.
Just for GP calls.
For a 24/7 GP helpline, physio, diagnostics and more. Now, tell me.
All about my medical history.
No medical questionnaires or hidden charges. We like to call it
healthcare done different.
Spot on. Benenden Health. Healthcare done different. Fee review periodically. 6-month wait for some services. T&Cs apply. Selected surgical procedures after 6 months. 24 in Northern Ireland. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe, only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year every year for career development. Like Juliet, She's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
10:34 is the time. It wasn't a glib question about when peaceful protesters worked, but I find my attention drawn to the television screen to my right, on which I learn that Syria is currently holding its first election since Assad was ousted, and that journey towards democracy, while I think it's far from over, was bloody and violent. So I'm leaving that question hanging. Peaceful protest changing the world. But I'm also going to remind you of the letter from Wing Commander Andrew Brooks, retired. The Home Secretary proposed to ban Palestine action on the ground of unacceptable criminal damage after they infiltrated RAF Brize Norton. In the 1980s, when I was UK commander of the RAF Green and Common Cruise Missile Base, I had a £250,000 annual budget to repair damage done by peace protesters to the perimeter fence. We had a strong Ministry of Defence police presence to stop intruders, often in a rather Benny Hill fashion. Yakety Sacks. The intruders were left in no doubt that if they tried to infiltrate the secure storage area with its 96 nuclear warheads, they would be shot by US Air Force military police, who were a mean crowd. There were thousands of such protesters threatening the base, but their freedom of speech was always respected, and I never heard anyone in Whitehall or the Pentagon suggest that they should be classed as terrorists. And today they would be. And also, if Shabana Mahmood's latest plan were to be enacted, they wouldn't be allowed to have their camp outside the fence of Greenham Common because of the cumulative impact on the people inside. Potentially, perhaps. So the more you talk about it, the worse it begins to look. I'm also going to remind you how carefully cultivated your initial reaction to words like civil liberty groups is, or even the name of Shami Chakrabarty, someone who's routinely demonised in the right-wing press. What are they so scared of? Now it's peaceful protest. Or at least it seems to be. David is in Hammersmith. David, what would you like to say?
Hello, James.
Hello.
I think it's really important to draw a distinction between saying, I support Palestine action and I support the Palestinian cause. And you
Yes, I completely
say,
agree. And I think some people are missing that point. I'm glad you've made it.
I think it's very missed. Hmm. And I think it's also perfectly legitimate to protest and say, I think the government made a big mistake prescribing Palestine action. Seems to me that's perfectly reasonable and lawful. But if you look at the way Palestine Action behaved, you know, basically breaking
allegedly,
into
hang on, these are live cases. I'm being hyper sensitive, but
right.
criminal damage is the accusation.
If it is proven,
yes.
If you want me to say that, if it is proven that they did what they are alleged to have done, and that wasn't the only instance of criminal damage and some quite unpleasant behaviour, then I think you have to say, hang on a minute, these are unpleasant people doing unpleasant things. They are not doing peaceful protest at all. And therefore, supporting them as opposed to the Palestinian cause is a very different thing. And
but any change in law would apply to all large-scale demonstrations over Gaza, and indeed anything else. It wouldn't just apply to the ones organised by Defend Our Juries, who I should remind you would very much challenge how you've typified some of the members and actions of Palestine Action. They wouldn't accept your analysis.
Well,
you know, damaging.
Then that's up to them.
Yes.
It's up to them to make the case.
But the law would apply to everybody. The law would apply to all protests, not just to the one that you don't think is.
Sorry, we haven't got onto that point yet. And on that point, I agree with you.
Yes.
Yesterday morning, when I heard Shabana Mahmood announce it, I thought, oh, that was quite a measured step.
Yeah.
But then I heard Shami Chakrabarty this morning saying, hang on a minute, you have to think more carefully about this. And I thought, actually, Shami Chakrabarty is right. I think on this point, I would agree with you. Mm. It it is probably going to be a step too far, because the fact that you repeat the protest shouldn't mean that it's wrong what you're doing. But I think one has to look really carefully at the people who are turning out with these signs saying, I support Palestine action, because they know perfectly well that what they're doing is unlawful. They know perfectly well they're liable to be arrested. They know perfectly well that they're wasting police time. And they know perfectly well that if they want to show solidarity with the Palestinian cause, or they want to object to the government's decision to prescribe Palestine action, they can say both of those things expressly and lawfully and do it peacefully. I think the idea that they're turning out to go, oh no, we're peaceful, but we're in favor, but we're actually speaking in favor of a prescribed organization, I just think that they are deeply sort of cynical and unpleasant and taking advantage of the situation. I reckon you have to look at their character on this one.
Okay.
Because there's perfectly lawful ways they could have made
their
points.
And I think you're even offered the choice to sort of go quietly, as it were, or to be carried off by police. You go limp. But this will sound a little odd. You deny people the right to be arrested if you're not careful. Not that is what you are saying, but the right to be arrested is actually oddly a civil liberty as well when you think about it. And just for the record, I can't conduct conversations like this without upsetting extraordinary numbers of people, but I disagree with you about what you said about the people protesting. I think that the interview I heard with Jonathan Porritt from Defend Our Juries, for me at the weekend, was a game changer. Actually, I should probably get him on, actually, so that you can hear it as well. But otherwise, yes, I think that the conflation of solidarity with Palestine with support for a prescribed organisation is unhelpful. But I can't read the souls of all the people that were there. I can't tell you how many of the 500 arrested or the 500 not arrested are guilty of the accusation that you're levelling at them. I do believe, for the record, that some of them almost certainly are. David, thank you. Tariq is in Chiswick. Tariq, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. So on that point, actually, just very quickly before I move on to mine, the action of that prescribed group, you know, does meet the threshold of them being prescribed as one. That's because their actions are politically motivated, and you know, the criminal damage that was done was essentially
done. It's a while since I had my legal refreshers, so I'm just touting everything like a participant in Have I Got News for You. I'm going to stick an allegedly on everything that you say.
No one's
disputing that there is a legal rationale for what they have done, but that's why I read out the letter from the former head of security, the UK commander even, of RAF Greenham Common, because that probably would have met the threshold as well, and yet they didn't, even with Margaret Thatcher in Downing Street, they didn't label these people terrorists, even though they were.
I completely agree, and that moves me on to the, you know, to the points I would like to raise. So, first of all, it's, you know, the importance of a protest is extremely important and necessary. And, you know, I would align this with the use of a pressure cooker. You know, that nozzle on the pressure cooker is essentially what the protest, or what a protest is. It allows that little bit of escape off steam to prevent the pot from essentially exploding. And I think, therefore, it's extremely necessary. And I think that is a pure demonstration of, you know, abuse of police powers, and I believe this is solely down to control, and it's misguided by absolute ignorance and foreign interference. Now, another quick point, and I think it's also
why foreign interference?
Well, you've got the likes of Elon Musk and the Trump remarks, and you know, all sorts of foreign interference that has quite an appetite in interfering with our, you know,
very much so, and
that moves us on to another key point, actually, and it's relevant to the horrific attack in Manchester. And I think it comes down to one thing alongside control, and it aids that bit of control, the use of language and words. You know, we are an informed nation, and with that said, we are constantly being manipulated by abuse of language and ignorance of translation and language. A prime example is the criminal that did what he did, or the terrorist that did what he did in Manchester. His name is Jihad. Now, It's very important, and if you would allow me just to explain what the name jihad means.
It means striving or struggle. It doesn't have any associations with...
Absolutely, correct.
I did that last week. Again, I don't know if I'm being a bit schoolmastery today, steering you and Ben and others back to the questions that we're actually asking. In a sentence or two, why are you uncomfortable with what Shabana Mahmood is proposing?
Because, again, you know, it's about control, and it's about abuse of control. And the thing is, some people weaponize specific actions within our society and overseas in order to push that extra bit of control. If this is about combating terrorism, I think that...
Well, it's not. No one is claiming that. It's about soothing the fears of Jewish people in this case. That is literally the language that Shabana Mahmood has used, exacerbated enormously, unbearably by the events in Manchester last week. But that, of course, leaves the government and people like you and me trying to have this conversation from any end of the spectrum in a really tricky situation, because you categorically accept that there is no justification or rationale for claiming that all Jewish people support what is going on in Gaza. Ben in Edgware probably made that point a lot more powerfully than I can or ever could. And yet you're also being told that protesting against what is going on in Gaza should be stopped because of the impact that it has on Jewish people. And it might not be a perfectly symmetrical dichotomy, that, but it's a difficult one to process, because, of course, you will also be banning lots and lots of Jewish people from protesting about what's going on in Gaza because of the feelings of some other Jewish people. And that's why, to me, it just looks really clumsy. And when I look at something clumsy, I try and work out where it's come from. And I think it's come from the also arguably clumsy prescription of Palestine action. And I say arguably because an awful lot of people will be getting in touch with me to point out that damaging aeroplanes is not the same on any conceivable level as damaging humans. It's 10:46.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC. We are one step closer to an end to the war in the Middle East. Should President Trump now be awarded a Nobel Peace Prize? And what role should former Prime Minister Sir Tony Blair now play? Join me, Tom Swarbrick, for the latest developments this afternoon from 4. Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the LBC app.
Fraud can happen faster than you think. But at Barclays, we use innovative technology that spots fraud in under a second. And our dedicated team of experts work 24/7. So you can go about your day knowing we never stop working to keep you and your money safe. Search Barclays Fraud Protection to see how you can stay one step ahead. Barclays. Make money work for you.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Welcome our new bookworms to the club. Now, do you read traditional books or e-books?
Oh, real books.
Traditional, oh. Always.
Yeah, quite.
I read e-books. Mm-hmm. I adjust it so the font's huge.
Oh, they make large font books.
Think bigger. Imagine Moby Dick all cuddled up with a book. His font size.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. Maybe it's time for varifocals. At Specsavers, get 2-for-1 varifocal glasses from £110. Conditions and exclusions apply. See online for details.
At Pets in a Pickle, we're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Play Set for Life from the National Lottery. Winners get 10k every month for 30 years. You could win on repeat. Set for Life. Play now on the National Lottery app. Terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Can your phone drown out irritating noises in your videos? Can anybody hear me over this? Luckily, Audio Eraser on the Galaxy S25 Ultra gets rid of background noises in seconds. Can your phone do that? Galaxy can. Get 15% off Galaxy S25 Ultra with code S15.
Buy from Samsung.com by the 21st of October 2025. Use code at checkout. Voucher code can't be combined with any other offer. Samsung account login and network connection required.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
10:49 is the time. Some rather sad news for you, actually, and it's a terrible thing to realise. I've only just realised it now, that if somebody famous passes away during the course of the show, the decision whether or not to talk about it or whether or not to tell you is... It's a surprisingly personal one. I don't know what criteria they use upstairs. I don't know what threshold of fame or importance you have to pass to make the news bulletin. But when I'm on air and it happens, and I'm sure the same is true for almost all, if not all of my colleagues, it's going to be a very personal decision. Somebody passes away who you know was really important and really famous, but who you never really clicked with or connected or I mean, some will be so huge that you have to cover it. And some, you'll just have very happy memories of, either personal or more likely professional, as in you responded to their work, which is an incredibly long-winded way, as I'm sure she would have pointed out, of telling you that Dame Gillie Cooper has died at the age of 88. And I am surprisingly emotional about that, not because I knew her well, but because she was unspeakably kind to me as a young gossip columnist. Not just me, she was unspeakably kind to all of us. And we never really knew why until we asked her. So when you're a gossip columnist, I don't know what it's like now, actually, but back in the day, there would be a dizzying array of events to attend. I had a colleague whose nickname was Two Doos, because he'd do at least two doos a night. You'd go to a book launch, you might go to a theatrical first night. Quite often I'd not even go to the play, but I'd go to the after party of the theatrical first night. And our job, as I think I've told you in the past, was to march up to all the famous people in the room and try to get them to say something that might make a paragraph in the next day's gossip column, or the day after the next day's gossip column, actually, the way that newspapers worked. And the other part of the job that was even more traumatizing looking back was ringing up famous people in the event that you were lucky enough to have the phone number. And I'm embarrassed to tell you, that this is going to be landlines. Landlines. Hardly any mobiles, actual landlines, and you were lucky enough to have them. I found my old Philofax the other day, and some of the people whose landline numbers I had in my Philofax, you would not believe. But you didn't have loads and loads, so the ones that you had, you'd often ring up quite often. Someone would come over from the showbiz desk and say, can you do me a ring round? Which means you'd get five or six famous people to comment on what their favourite biscuit was or how they felt about England's chances in the World Cup or whatever it was. And this is where your contacts book was your fortune. And quite understandably, most of the famous people that you rang up were not very patient. And I remember one very famous actor telling me to F off and slamming the phone down. Actually, no, that was a very famous chat show host. Oh, Lord, that's narrowed it down a bit, hasn't it, when you think about the era that we're discussing. Gillie Cooper, when you rang her up, and you'd be asking her the most banal and ridiculous of questions, was utterly, utterly charming. Utterly charming. And the reason for it was that she'd done the job herself. I didn't know that at the time. She'd done those jobs herself. She'd done those thankless ring-arounds to whatever poor celebrities had somehow ended up having their phone number in your Philofax. And she'd done the parties when you'd go up to people and they often struggled to hide the fact that they couldn't wait to get rid of you. But she was utterly, utterly charming. She was utterly lovely. And and my friend Henry, who was a much better gossip columnist than I ever was, I think he ended up, she was trying to set him up on dates with her daughter or something. I mean, he was a very smooth character, but she just treated you like a human being at a time in our careers when some people didn't really treat us like human beings. And I also, and you can judge me for this as much as you want, I also loved her books. Absolutely loved her books. Not in the later years, I've moved on to other things, but I was right up to the one about the conductor. Not just the TV and the horses, Rupert Campbell Black, Declan O'Hara. I was right up to the one about the conductor. I forget what that book was called, but that I was still on board by the time she got around to that. Moved from TV to move from horse jumping to TV to operas to classical music. So farewell, Jilly Cooper. They don't make him like that anymore. Absolutely lovely woman. And if you're just joining us, I can tell you that she's died suddenly at the age of 88, following a fall. Her family have announced the news today. Her children, Felix and Emily, issuing a statement to confirm their mother died yesterday morning, saying, "Mum was the shining light in all our lives. Her love for all of her family and friends knew no bounds. Her unexpected death has come as a complete shock. We are so proud of everything she achieved in her life and can't begin to imagine life without her infectious smile and laughter all around us. And I am here to tell you that in my limited experience of Jilly Cooper, that is absolutely on the money." It's coming up to 5 to 11. We return to the major story of the morning, which is the Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood's questionable plan to give the police more powers to close down or move on static protests or marches. And I want to stress, I am talking about completely peaceful ones, like the one this weekend. And the reason given is the cumulative impact of similar demonstrations on other members of the public. In the case of Gaza protests, she chooses to talk about the Jewish community being upset by the protest, which I also think is unhelpful, because it suggests that demonstrating against genocide is somehow a demonstration against Jewish people, which is pretty close to the definition of anti-Semitism, but that is a judgment that rarely gets made in that direction. So what do you think? Amanda is in Dublin. Amanda, what would you like to say?
Hey, yeah, I do think that that what Shabana Mahmood is doing is wrong. Peaceful protests should be allowed to be carried out. I do think as well that this idea that you said about the the anti-Semitism of it, and how the protest last week would upset Jewish people. Yeah, I agree with your point totally on that one.
It's a confusion rather than a point. I wouldn't dream of suggesting that Jewish people support what's going on in Gaza. So to protest against what's going on in Gaza on the grounds that it upsets Jewish people seems to have an uncomfortable symmetry to me. That's all.
Yeah. In Ireland, we've been protesting we haven't been prescribed as groups at all. Some people have been arrested at certain points, but mainly it's been peaceful protests there, and no one has, they've been allowed by the authorities and supported by the authorities. So I was on the biggest one this weekend.
Well, we've had that as well. I mean, you remind us, actually, of the... I think the roots of this is probably the proscription of Palestine Action. If any of the groups you're allied with had actually allegedly mounted attacks on military bases, then you'd be in a slightly different position. So none of the other marches that have gone on, none of the other protests that have gone on are in this space, but they would be under threat. It's just the one that happened this weekend that seems to have focused the Home Secretary's mind. And that could be because the police have had enough. You know, they've had enough of arresting little old ladies and blind people, and they know that they're going to have to unless she does something, and that she's got two choices. She either bans the protests or she lifts the proscription.
The other thing is, I mean, I've been listening to UK news all the way through the weekend, and nobody has actually... All of the stuff has been about whether Shabana Mahmood is going to kind of impose stricter rules on protests. But nobody's actually said 500 people were arrested, humanitarians, on a humanitarian mission in international waters just outside of Gaza. And all of these international citizens have been arrested, 500 of them. They're in Israeli prisons at the moment for trying to bring baby food to Gaza.
How big a story is that in Ireland? How big a story is that in Ireland?
It's in the news. It's in the news because we've...
Well, it has been in the news here, but it hasn't received the coverage that perhaps it has elsewhere. I know that in Italy this is an absolutely huge story. And we've got British people caught up in it as well. I'm aware of one who's a former RAF pilot whose family... believed he was being held in hideous circumstances in the desert. I don't know the outcome of that. I was going to check in after the show, actually, and find out what the latest development was. But yes, you're right. I mean, it's not whataboutery. It is a simple reminder of what is being protested against and a question of what you are and are not allowed to do. And the answer is that what you are allowed to do in protest or support of the Palestinian people seems to be diminishing daily sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, we had the biggest march ever in Dublin, I think. There were just thousands and thousands of us. But we were protesting as well because... but also, your point, you were saying about when is peaceful protests, when is it successful?
Yes.
We've been protesting for months about the Irish Central Bank rubber stamping Israeli war bonds and saying that it shouldn't be allowed and that... And that's been going on for months. Israel, the Irish Central Bank no longer rubber stamps the Israeli war bonds. It's gone to Luxembourg or something. So that is an example of peaceful protest that has actually worked.
No, I think there's an Irish senator in the flotilla as well, isn't there?
An Irish senator.
Amanda as well. So a reminder, I'm just moving on solely because the news is... upon us of how different the world can look depending on where you're looking at it from. We should probably do more on that flotilla ourselves. Thank you, Amanda. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Shall we do true or false on the 10 interesting things about Mel Stride that are being circulated around the Conservative Party conference in the hope of whipping up some excitement for his speech? He's written a novel that hasn't been published. So this is the job you've got to do. Mel, tell us 10 interesting things about yourself. Oh, okay. There's an unwritten novel sitting on my shelf. True or false? I'll tell you after this.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the Shadow Chancellor has used a keynote speech to claim the Conservatives are the only party that'll stand up for fiscal responsibility. So Mel Stride has promised to save nearly £50 billion of taxpayers' money if the Tories win the next general election. The party says the plans will be funded by cuts to public spending in areas including welfare and the foreign aid budget. So Mel told delegates at the party's conference in Manchester, where Labour choose debt, the Tories choose discipline.
All they have to offer is pessimism, higher taxes, fewer jobs, lower growth, and a mountain of debt for the next generation. What we stand for is something far bigger. Conservative values, opportunity, aspiration, optimism. We are the party of hope. We are the party of the future. We can and we will.
Labour says the Conservatives can't be trusted on the issue, given their record in government. Talks between mediators representing Israel and Hamas are taking place in Egypt today. The negotiations will focus on a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages under President Trump's peace plan. So breaking news this hour, the author Dame Jilly Cooper has died at the age of 88. Her family say she passed away yesterday morning after a fall. 11 million copies of her books were sold in the UK during a career lasting more than 50 years. She's best known for her Rutshire Chronicles series, which included the best-selling romance novels Riders and Rivals. A major shake-up of the housing market is being planned to make buying and selling easier and quicker. Binding contracts could be introduced at an earlier stage, while sellers could have to share more details about a property up front. The Communities Minister, Mayatta von Bulis, told LBC it's an archaic system that needs streamlining.
This is the biggest shake-up of the home buy and seller market that we've seen in a generation that we think will cut the process down by 4 weeks, will critically reduce by half the number of failed transactions. At the moment, failed transactions are costing consumers collectively about 400 million, industry about a billion, and critically will deliver £700 savings for first-time buyers.
And Jaguar Land Rover is expecting to restart some of its production in the UK this week. All manufacturing was paused at the end of August after a major cyber attack. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 14 at £94.76. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloudy but dry for most today. Rain in northern areas but some sunny spells in the southeast with highs of 19 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers on my birthday. And 95 minutes late. But it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop. Plus, free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado. Life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60 and charges apply. Max saving £20. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 4 minutes after 11 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. It is true. On the list of 10 interesting things about Mel Stride that you may not have known, the fact that he wrote a novel that is yet to be published makes the final cut. Goodness knows what else is going to be. Goodness knows what didn't. If you're looking for 10 interesting things about Mel Stride and the fact that he's written a novel that wasn't published, to which the correct response is, neither have I, then you have to wonder about what else was put forward as for possible inclusion but wasn't actually considered interesting enough compared to the fact that he's written a novel that's never been published to make the final list. It's set in the 1960s music scene in the United States of America. Be Still, My Beating Heart. How do you want to do this conversation? I think we should. I think it's important. And I think that Gary Neville is the latest proof of how hard it is to find a voice in public discourse in this country, a voice with a big platform that is prepared to address some uncomfortable truths about the lurch rightwards that the country is currently undertaking. It fell to Gary Lineker for a very long time, and he continues, of course, to pursue his political position, various political positions, recently picking up an award that no one else had won for 23 years. It was the Anton Deck Award at the National Television Awards. Partly, he contended from the stage as a consequence of people wanting to show support for his political stances. Obviously, nobody, including him, condones the hideous imagery that was contained within a clip that he unwittingly posted on social media, but the knives were out for him for a variety of reasons long before Israel started its attacks on Gaza or Hamas undertook its a terrorist attack upon Israeli territory. The knives are out for Gary Lineker probably from Brexit onwards. The miracle he lasted as long as he did. In fact, one of the only reasons he lasted as long as he did was because of all of his colleagues at the BBC downed tools last time they tried to take him off air. So Gary Neville, who doesn't really work for the BBC, I think he does most of his football punditry on Sky, has stepped into the breach. Few people, probably, on a routine basis, apart from the armed forces, few people have a personal, professional relationship with the flag of England in particular than England football players, you know? It's a position that most of us don't really think about. But if you're an England player, then that cross of St. George is crucial. And he's chosen to point out that for an awful lot of people, they look like an act of aggression. And that's not, I'm afraid, an opinion. That's counting. An awful lot of people think that a lot of these flags are an act of aggression. It is clearly true that some people who put flags up, particularly in their own homes, are not doing so in order to make anybody else feel unwelcome. But it is within living memory that people would chant on the streets of the United Kingdom, "There ain't no black in the Union Jack." And clearly some of the people embracing the return of the flag as a sign of, well, you fill in the gaps on that, are nostalgic for those days, but it would be ridiculous to suggest it was all of them, and even a majority of them. But it's true to say that the flag itself feels to many people like a marking out of territory. It is a message being sent to people who aren't white that simply says, "You are not welcome here. This is our territory," and it's deeply, deeply disingenuous of people, particularly in the media, to pretend otherwise. And you look at some of the characters involved in organising these campaigns, and it becomes impossible to sustain the idea that it is not designed in part to mark out territory or to say you are not welcome here. And it shouldn't be controversial to come out and say that. It really shouldn't. But of course it is. Because, well, I don't know that you need to hear my theories or thoughts on why it is, but it is increasingly clear that many members of the media have gone mad. And therefore, although they can remember the days of there ain't no black in the Union flag, or there ain't no black in the Union Jack, they're pretending that that is not an echo that can be heard again today. They're pretending that it's got absolutely nothing to do with racism or ethnicity or ethno-nationalism, to coin a phrase. And that's why Gary Neville, I think, has been quite bold, because he has now painted a rather large target on his back, probably bigger than he himself realised when he did this. The response will be very predictable and very obvious and free of all nuance and probably quite unpleasant as well. I want you to have a little listen to what he said. It's quite long, but I think it's worth listening to all of it. I want you to bear two things in mind. The first is that I'm going to ask you at the end of it what you think, purely and simply, and then I'll tell you what I think. And the second thing I want you to bear in mind is that he doesn't have to do this. He's got, I think his business empire is worth about £100 million. I don't know what his personal fortune is. He doesn't have to do any of this. And then I might do that thing that I do every couple of weeks when I ask you to make a list of all the people who are actually paid in the British media for their opinions, who lean even a tiny, tiny little bit towards the left, or are even a tiny, tiny little bit repelled by the hideous rhetoric of the Daily Mail or the Daily Telegraph. Because I'll tell you what, it won't take you very long to make that list. And Gary Neville won't be on it, because he is not getting paid for this. This is not his job. This is his patriotic duty, he would say, to stand up against what he sees as deeply unpleasant and very deliberately divisive behaviour. And that's why I want you to listen carefully to his words with those thoughts, the fact that he doesn't have to do it, because I might even ask you why you think he has. He doesn't have to do it, and hardly anybody can. Doesn't mean he's right, but it means that we should probably listen to him.
So I've just left my house, and then walking into the office, waking up obviously, seeing the news last night and the news this morning dominated by the horrific attacks within the Jewish community, just about a mile from here. And was driving home from Salford City last night, I was driving out to Salford City, going down a Littleton Road, seeing 60, probably 50 or 60 Union Jack flags. And on the way back, I went down the parallel road, which is Berenew Road, which has got the Jewish community right at its heart. And they're out on the streets, defiant, not hiding or in fear. And I just kept thinking as I was driving home last night that we're all being turned on each other. And the division that's being created is absolutely disgusting. Mainly created by angry, middle-aged white men who know exactly what they're doing. Funnily enough, on one of my development sites last week, there was a Union Jack flag put up, and I took it down instantly. And some people might be watching this and thinking, well, Gary, you're not very patriotic. I've played my country 85 times. I love my country. I love Manchester and I love England. But I've been building in this city for 15, 20 years, and there's no one put a Union Jack, a Jack flag up in the last 15 to 20 years, so why do you need to put one up now? Because quite clearly it's sending a message to everybody that there is something you don't like. The Union Jack flag being used in a negative fashion is not right. And I'm a proud supporter of England, of Great Britain, of our country, and we're championing it anywhere in the world as being one of the greatest places to live. But I think we need to check ourselves. We need to check ourselves and sort of start to think about bringing ourselves back to a neutral point. because we're being pulled right and left, and we don't need to be pulled right and left at all. I've always said this about, I played in a football team with a group of people from Manchester, a group of people from Ireland, Wales, Scotland, but also people from Africa, people from Asia, people from America, people from Europe, and we were a beautiful team, united as one. Brexit has had a devastating impact on this country, and the messaging is getting dangerous, extremely dangerous. All these idiots that are out there spreading hate speech in any form and abuse in any form, we must stop promoting them. We must stop elevating our voices towards them. And it needs to stop now and get back to a country of love, of peace, of harmony, and become a team again.
It's got elements of Dear England, that, the letter that another... another Gary, actually, although known more popularly as Gareth Southgate. That's three Garys. That's it. You could, I mean, I say make a list of people with a big public platform who routinely stand against racism, and they're all called Gary. Gary Lineker, Gary Neville, and Gareth Southgate. But the Dear England letter that Gareth Southgate wrote after three of his players received hideous, hideous racist abuse from, I think many people would argue, the kind of characters who may be now putting flags on your local lampposts. But, again, I revering a flag is definitely not a sign of racism, but I don't know that anything that Gary Neville said is particularly disputable. So, shall we have a look at that question? It's been going on for 15 years. Why do you need to put one up now? 0345 6060973. So, respond, if you would, to... that speech that you've just heard, that small thing that you've heard, bearing in mind, if you can, that he didn't have to do it. It's not his job to have opinions. He chose to do that. So regardless of what you think about his words, I think you have to accept that it comes from the heart. So that question that he asks, I want your general views, your general responses to what you heard, 0345 6060973. But I also think we should all try to answer that question. So whether it's you or they, whether it's why do you need to put one up now after 15 years of not putting them up, that's the period he's spanning over. I mean, the last time that they were routinely used in any political sense was when the phrase "there ain't no black in the Union Jack" was part of popular parlance. So why now? Why is it happening now? 0345 6060973. So there's two questions. What do you think of Gary Neville's intervention? 0345 6060973. And why are the flags happening now? You can answer that from either side. Actually, all three positions: in favour of them, opposed to them, or ambivalent about them. I know for a fact that they upset, but people feel threatened by the implicit suggestion that, well, it's not even implicit. There ain't no black in the Union Jack. It is a form of ethno-nationalism in the eyes of many people who don't belong to the, quotes, right, end quotes, ethnicity. And you can tell me a million times that when you hung up a flag from your local lamppost, it was categorically not intended in any way to make anybody feel unwelcome. And that's fine. But usually, manners would dictate that if I did something that you then told me was profoundly offensive, and I reflected upon it and thought, good Lord, I really don't want to be responsible for your upset, therefore I'm going to apologise and I'm not going to do it again. Even if I want to argue that that was not my intention at all, even if it really wasn't my intention at all, even if I don't think you should be as upset as you are about it because I know what is in my heart, I also now know what is in your heart. And what is in your heart is fear and aggression, a fear of aggression. So I would, at that point, simply say, okay, yeah, we probably don't need this. We certainly don't need it on the sort of scale that we're seeing in some corners of the country. And anybody, but with their full chest, pretending that there is no question here about racism, I'm afraid needs to pay a very quick visit to the 1970s, when both of these flags were co-opted completely by the far right in the most hideous of fashions. And I don't think this needs explaining, to be honest, because anybody apparently not understanding this is almost certainly pretending. But the reason why they got the flags out at the Labour Party conference was as an attempt to reclaim the flag from the forces of the far right, who dominated it in the 1970s and are trying to dominate it again now. So what do you think of Gary Neville? Not as a defender or as a football player, but as this intervention in public discourse. And why do you or they need to put them up now? I suppose I'd say why now and why so many? What are they designed to do? 18 minutes after 11 is the time.
This is LBC.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It is 20 minutes after 11. I know this is a bit of a pet subject of mine, and there's probably an element of self-aggrandisement in it as well, but it really is striking how few voices there are in public discourse making the kind of points that Gary Neville made this weekend, accusing angry middle-aged white men of dividing Britain with this extraordinary campaign or mission of hanging up flags, and all over the shop. And he's not paid. He's not even a columnist or a commentator, a professional opiner. Make a list of all the people who will be queuing up to attack Gary Neville. You'll be here all week. Make a list of people in the UK media who are paid for their opinions and recognise that what Gary Neville is saying is largely right, and you probably won't even get us to the next news bulletin. That's just worth mentioning a lot, because there's a reason for it. There's a reason for it. Peter is in Stockport, not far from where Gary Neville was when he recorded this little message. Peter, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. I'm completely in support of what his message was, and I'd like to put a couple of points to say why I think that. First of all, I'm a middle-aged white man, so I'm not taking any offence whatsoever at that point of it.
Well, you're not. Maybe you're not angry, so if you were angry, you would be taking offence at it.
Yeah, well, this whole subject is it's really hitting the subject, because a couple of weeks ago there were no flags in my village, and now they're on every single lamppost.
Really?
And flags are basically, if you look at the history of them, people went marched into war behind a flag that you could identify who it was to attack or who not to attack. And what we've got at this situation now is we're getting people trying to stand up and say, yeah, it's great to be British, but what has anybody done to be British apart from be born? That's something that's completely out of their control. And we're just trying to rile up people to get behind a flag, but what are they proud of? I'm proud of freedom of speech. I'm proud of a lot of things about being British, but there's a lot of parts of our history that I'm absolutely ashamed of. And just putting a banner on something and saying, let's get behind this no matter what, our freedom of speech, our ability to stand up and say, you know, disagree and criticise particular movements is fundamental. We should be proud of being British, but putting flags up and just forcing people to pick a side is just wrong. I'm 100% behind him on that point.
Why now? Why is it happening now? Because that was the bit that I don't think I'd thought about before Gary Neville said it. He said, I've been, you know, here for 15 years. I've never seen one before. Why do you need to put one up now?
Well, it's easy to sort of galvanise people behind it.
And, but that would have been true. That would have been true a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
didn't even have it during Brexit, when there was an awful lot of false patriotism out there. I mean, loads of it was weapons grade, but I don't remember this particular type of people sort of scuttling around in the middle of the night, putting flags on lampposts, and then desperately, desperately hoping that a council might come along and take one down so that they can get into the Daily Mail.
I am stumbling with...
With the now of it,
absolutely. But I just see it, you see it more and more. It becomes more prominent. Everything post-Brexit seems to have been... I think I was really quite ignorant to how racist... how much of an undercurrent of racism there has been. And then since I've heard so much more outright attacks on people. I was in a supermarket and there was, a woman from, Middle Eastern descent, and there was a guy causing a stink, demanding to see a passport.
Shut up.
And there was a commotion, and I was just confused. I was like, what's this about? And he was absolutely massive, and the security had to call the police. But it's just getting to that state now where it is so aggressive on...
But look at the now of it. I'm struggling with it as well, but I wonder if it is a kind of overflow from what Twitter became after Elon Musk bought it, and other social media sites as well. But the racism there now goes absolutely unchecked and unchallenged, and it's commoditized. You know, you're actually going to get money. The more racist you are on there, the more money you're going to make. And at some point, maybe it breaches the online world and arrives in the real world, in the physical world. That's just a thought. I mean, I'm looking at the now of it, and I'm wondering why, as Gary Neville asks, why it's happening now. Whether or not it is designed to intimidate is inarguable. Whether or not it's always designed to intimidate is arguable. If your granddad flies a flag from a pole in his back garden and goes out to play the bugle and salute it at 6 o'clock every evening when the sun comes over the yard arm, that's just quite sweet and nice. But if you're going out in under darkness and draping countless lampposts with these flags, what are you doing? It's not a sign of pride in your country, because 2 months from now there'll be tatty rags. It's anything but a sign of pride in your country. It's almost the opposite. So what is the reason for it, and why is it happening now? 0345 6060 973. Thank you, Peter. Farouk is in Maidstone. Farouk, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi, James. Thank you very much for taking my call. First of all, let me say one thing. I'm absolutely, I would say the word is emotional. Having heard this lovely sort of chap, I mean, I never knew Gary the way I know him now after this short piece you played of his. A great defender, a footballer, but I think he's a great defender of the future of the world, in a sense, because we are going in the direction where we need to have some top statesmen to save the world at the moment, to be honest. We haven't got any, unfortunately.
It feels that way.
The people up there should have been there. Look, even this is a very unified kind of a force working against sanity at the moment, I think. And you asked the right question, why now? Well, it has been building up, and I think Gary Neville said something quite pertinent, that ever since the Brexit happened, probably, I think that it was a watershed moment anyway. And whether the force was already there to make it happen, but these things really were more like catalysts. Just like we keep saying COVID has caused a lot of problems in the world, whether there was a cause or was one of the reasons why the problems became more prevalent and more hurried, to capture, you know, where we are now. So I think the most important thing is that at least this, the reason I got emotional after listening to this, that sort of, a little speech by him, is because I thought we are feeling very, very, very hopeless right now. There's a lot of hopelessness out there. I mean, I'm myself a practicing Muslim myself, and also very proud. Again, I don't have to say that. Very proud British. I must say that, but I'm saying it still. That, yes. I mean, I don't have to defend my position, I don't have to sort of, in a way, be apologist for those people who do the wrong things. But I mean, the funny thing is that whenever something like, you know, it was very unfortunate what happened at the synagogue, this complete lunatic terrorist killed two individuals, who were innocent, it does break everyone's heart. But having said that, all of a sudden you start hearing very well-planned kind of rhetoric that comes from left, right, and center, saying, look, we are all together. It's not just Jewish people, as if they're trying to build a bigger force with these people who call themselves Jewish. I mean, and there are a lot of Jewish friends I have personally. And I think you said the right thing at the beginning, that do not conflate Judaism or Jewish people with State of Israel. But unfortunately, those sinister people who are in every religion in the world, they are extremists who are Muslims, they're extremists who are Jews, right? And therefore, those extremist elements find this as a very interesting, very useful platform, these events, and they start saying, we all together, as if the Western world is all united, Jews and non-Jews, for the defense of Israel, in a way, and these backward-looking or backward Muslims were complete they are savages, they don't know how to live, they're not civilized people. This is how it comes out. And I feel every day goes past, I'm a father myself, I'm struggling all the time how to bring up my children and still love their country, because this is the country I love more than any other place in the world. And how can I? But they keep listening, because this is what social media is.
It's conflation. I think it's the most common word on the program at the moment. Conflation is that somebody from a certain background or ethnicity does something absolutely awful, and the people you're describing move immediately to try to portray everybody from that background or ethnicity as somehow being complicit or part of the problem. I guess the Epping Hotel was the first really, really big public example of that, where one man committed a crime. And I think had already been arrested for it, and yet the desperate attempts to claim that every asylum seeker was somehow a sex offender or dodgy. The Southport killings, of course, saw people telling lies about the culprit in order to try to foment hatred of people who had absolutely nothing. Why would you attack a hotel with asylum seekers in it, even if an asylum seeker had committed a crime? It's not as if you would attack Old Trafford if a Manchester United fan committed a crime, or go after every Capricorn in the country if somebody born in January was a sex offender. It's insane, and that's what you're talking about, that conflation. And I do think that the flags are part of that process. That's why Gary Neville is talking about division. And when you look at the now of it, I think part of it is that public discourse has relatively recently once again returned to the 1970s and embraced people or platformed people talking about how you can't be British if you're brown, or you can't be English if you're black. And to me, that's not a coincidence. The timing of that rhetoric returning to public discourse is exactly the same as the rhetoric of there ain't no black in the Union Jack returning to public discourse. How could you mark that? Well, by putting up loads of flags. Farouk, I hope you feel better, mate. I know this sounds a bit hollow, but I'm going to carry on saying it. There are more of us, and good will always prevail. It's just the question of when. Here's Dominic Ellis with your headlines.
The Shadow Chancellor has told the Conservative Conference that theirs is the party of opportunity, aspiration and achievement. Sir Mel Stride has criticised the government for, as he sees it, allowing spending to run out of control. Talks between mediators representing Israel and Hamas are due to take place in Egypt. Negotiations will focus on a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages. And the author Dame Jilly Cooper has died at the age of 88. She's best known for her Ratcha Chronicle series, which included the best-selling romance novels Riders and Rivals. LBC weather, cloudy but dry for most today. Some rain in northern areas, sunny spells in the southeast with highs of 19 degrees.
This is LBC.
Across the UK, people like Phil face their toughest challenges alone.
It's a pain that I feel like the body can't comprehend losing a child, because you are not supposed to outlive your children.
LBC's charity, Make Some Noise, is here to support people like Phil.
It's kind of a family that you never wanted to be a part of, and you would never choose to be a part of it. But now you're in it, you don't know what you'd do without.
You can change lives. Donate now at makesomenoise.com. Proudly supported by Furniture Village.
Can your phone drown out irritating noises in your videos? Can anybody hear me over this? Luckily, Audio Eraser on the Galaxy S25 Ultra gets rid of background noises in seconds. Can your phone do that? Galaxy can. Get 15% off Galaxy S25 Ultra with code S15.
Buy from Samsung.com by the 21st of October 2025. Use code at checkout. Voucher code can't be combined with any other offer. Samsung account login and network connection required.
At TfL, we're helping make roads safer.
We're continuing to roll out lower speed limits because 20 miles per hour roads have already seen 24% fewer collisions causing death or serious injury. We're also improving junctions to help keep you safe and improving visibility for our bus drivers with new wing mirror cameras. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Comparison of collisions data before and after implementation of 20 miles per hour speed limit.
Fraud can happen faster than you think. But at Barclays, we use innovative technology that spots fraud in under a second. And our dedicated team of experts work 24/7. So you can go about your day knowing we never stop working to keep you and your money safe. Search Barclays Fraud Protection to see how you can stay one step ahead. Barclays, make money work for you.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It's 11:34. A lovely message. I've lost it now, so I'm sorry I can't. So I think you might have been another James. But I got a lovely message saying, I know you're obsessed with class, so I thought you'd be amused to know that when you started talking about Jilly Cooper's book about a conductor, my immediate thought was a bus conductor. it was a Passionata, it was called. It was one of the later books in the Rutscher Chronicles, and it was about classical music. The hero of it was a violinist, I think, and then there was a horrible conductor in it who had all manner of bad habits. Anyway, I digress. I may try and get my friend on, who was very, very well treated by Dame Jilly Cooper in the very earliest days of our journalistic career. Because sometimes I think you learn more about a person from the stuff that happened in the shadows, away from the public sphere, than you do from the stuff that happened very much on full display. 11:35 is the time. Gary Neville has. Well, I mean, he's recorded an extremely poignant and measured response to the current craze for sticking flags up everywhere, and he has described himself as disturbed by it, posting a video on social media simply discussing how divisive they obviously are. You heard him reference the appalling events in Manchester last week, but for some reason the Daily Mail is trying to push that to the forefront of his comments. I mean, it didn't to me sound like a speech that was referencing the event, that the terrorist attack in Manchester, anything other than sort of chronologically. It wasn't linking the flag. Well, I don't think he was, but anyway, the Daily Mail are obviously going to be attacking him for pointing out that this feels in many ways like a return to the days of there ain't no black in the Union Jack. But, you know, go back a few more years and the Daily Mail had a front page saying hurrah for the black shirts. So, plus ça change there. And they also pretend that this somehow puts him at odds with Keir Starmer. It's so weird, isn't it? So here is a racist with a flag. All right, let's say it's 1978. Here's a National Front march. Here's a racist with a flag shouting on the streets of London, there ain't no black in the Union Jack. And then here is Gary Neville with a Union Jack. Oh, no, here's Keir Starmer with a Union Jack saying, as he said last week, we will never let the Union flag be surrendered to those that use it as a symbol of violence, fear and division. So this is what passes for logic now in the Daily Mail. So here's Gary Neville. Here is a member of the National Front using the Union Jack to articulate his hatred of black people. And here is Keir Starmer saying, we will never let the Union Jack become something that articulates hatred of black people. And here's the Daily Mail saying, oh, well, that puts Gary Neville at odds with Keir Starmer. How do you work that out, lads? Seriously, here's the person using the flag as a tool of racism. Here's the person saying we must never let them use the flag as a tool of racism. And here's Gary Neville saying some people are using the flag as a tool of racism. That puts him at odds with Keir Starmer, who said we should never let people use the flag as a tool of racism. You see how it works? Once you go into this weird tumble dryer of bigotry and prejudice, logic disappears. Logic goes out the window immediately. And it leaves you trying to make terrible, non-existent associations. Like the front page of this newspaper, the day after the Manchester terror attacks, tried to blame it on woke police officers or woke chief constables. Does that even mean? So Gary Neville comes along and says people are being very, very divisive. He doesn't say, for example, using a terrorist atrocity at a synagogue in Manchester to attack the police on the front page of the Daily Mail. Doesn't get much more divisive than that. It just focuses on the flags. And he asks an extremely pertinent question. Why now? I'm asking a slightly less pertinent question, which is, what do you think of what Gary Neville has said? And I'm also asking you what he's asked, which is, why now? Why now? Patrick's in Bow. Patrick, what would you like to say?
Hi, good morning, James.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to be speaking with you. It's my first time calling into your show.
Welcome aboard.
I've listened to everything you've said in the last few callers, and quite simply, the reason why this is happening now is, not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it's quite frankly because of the media. They've amplified this rhetoric in the last year or so, which I think times with Labour's victory in the polls while coming to government, because they've wanted to create this onslaught and distraction away from the reasons why the cost of living keeps increasing. So 14 years of failure, there's no answer to fixing that from the government, the previous government, and so they've got to attack immigrants, demonise everyone, and get our flags up to just try and distract everyone from the issues.
Because they want everything. Again, I've got a mild obsession with the Daily Mail, but, you know, I use it as a figure of speech to describe the movements and the forces that you're talking about, much bigger than one newspaper, especially in the current climate. But they want everything. They won. Yeah. They got their austerity. They got their Brexit. They got their man into Downing Street. They got Boris Johnson into Downing Street. They got Liz Truss's ludicrous budget, which was practically written by the Tufton Street stink tanks. They got absolutely everything they wanted, and the whole thing's fallen apart. So what the hell else can they do now? What on earth can they do now? And the answer is, oh, look, here's Nigel Farage, and also let's really hate on the foreigners. And not even on the foreigners. Let's really hate upon the British people, who are a slightly different shade to us.
Absolutely. And I've got an example here. So I've got a colleague who I work with, and he lives in Scotland, in quite a nice part of Scotland. And he told me last week that through his front door, he got a letter which was printed, I guess, on a home PC, which said, get out, P-word. Mm-hmm. And when he checked his Ring doorbell, it was actually a child, looked about 12, 13 years old, who put this through his front door and also his neighbour's post boxes. And so, of course, he got out of his door when he got home and spoke to his neighbour, who was, you know, fully white British, if you like, because he's mixed. And they laughed about it, didn't report it. But this is what this media amplification of reform and distraction has come to. You've got children engaging in rhetoric, which we've not seen for 50 years. Myself, I'm 37. I've lived in this country, born and raised here. And I can also agree with the other callers in that I now feel conscious of my colour for the first time. And it's very sad because, you know, I've paid taxes my whole life, never claimed benefits, never, you know, got a clean criminal record, everything that you'd hope a member of society has.
It breaks my heart that you feel the need to say that, because, of course, there's loads of people involved in these so-called protests who are none of those things. And yet they're the ones who claim to be upholding patriotism. I don't think, I mean, I'm often wary of simple answers to complicated questions, but it's not actually a very complicated question. Why are they working so hard now to normalise this? 2014, Patrick, The Sun described Nigel Farage's comments to me, actually, as racist. Pure and simple was the phrase that they used. Because they were. And he is, you know, it's there. That's it. That's all that's happening. Whereas now, you know, they're telling lies about Keir Starmer trying to get him killed or something by simply describing one of the policies that they've introduced as racist, telling hideous lies. How are you supposed to respond to the suggestion that the terrorist in Manchester was the result of woke chief constables? And how are you supposed to respond to lies that when Keir Starmer uses the same language that The Sun used in 2014 to describe Nigel Farage's conduct, i.e. racism, pure and simple, that they're somehow announcing a death sentence on him or trying to get him hurt? It's simply because everything has fallen apart, and the alternative would now be to tell the truth, would now be to put your hands up and say, yeah, sorry, that's all our fault. That's all our fault. We should never have let Boris Johnson anyway. Oh, by the way, we've given him a column in our newspaper now. Should never have let Brexit happen. Should never have done all of these things we told you were going to be brilliant. They've all been bloody awful, so please blame brown people.
Absolutely. I think, to be honest, I think I've got the short answer to this. I've looked at this in quite some detail, and I think what's happened in this country, the media have looked at what's happening in the US. They've seen Trump has come in, and this distraction appears to be working. So they've decided to ramp up the rhetoric here in terms of demonising immigrants, because they think, you know what, let's keep people angry at each other whilst we
get away with murder. We'll rob the place. We'll rob the place blind.
We'll rob the taxpayer blind.
Yeah, and they are. And some of the stuff that's going on in America now, which we're going to talk about this week, is off the charts. I've been thinking about this. You say you've been thinking about it a lot. I'm fascinated by the F word. fascism. And one thing that's really helpful, if you've got this opportunity, is to talk to people for whom fascism is a real part of their living memory. So I know, as you know, a lot of Greek people, and the ones that are a little older than me, lived in essentially fascist dictatorship. They know what it is like to have full-on propagandists on their television pouring poison into the ears of the population. And they know what it is like to have people locked up for dissent, people imprisoned for the crime of criticizing a government or a regime. Speak to people for whom actual fascism is a real and living memory, and ask them what they think about what's going on in the United States of America, and you will get some very, very frightening answers. We are a little, I don't want to say blasé, what's a better word for that? We're a little complacent here. An American called Upton Sinclair wrote a book called It Couldn't Happen Here. I think I've remembered the title, which essentially sums up this very naive idea that these kind of things are, oh, that's for the warmer climes. You only get that sort of behavior in countries not like this one. We've come close in this country on a couple of occasions. Oswald Mosley was enjoying enormous amounts of support from the establishment, up to and including, as I mentioned a moment ago, the owner of the Daily Mail at the time. And if it wasn't for what Hitler started doing with regards to his imperial ambitions, then support in this country for Oswald Mosley would not necessarily have gone off a cliff. And then, I think rather less known, when Harold Wilson was Prime Minister, there was talk of, from some very, very powerful people, of some form of military coup to get him out of Downing Street. So it could happen here. And it is happening in the United States of America, in my humble opinion. I was talking to Yanis Varoufakis on Saturday night, the former Greek finance minister, who's written an extraordinary book about his family history of resistance and the people in his family tree, very close relatives, his mother, both of his grandmothers, his daughter's grandmother from her mother's side of the family. All of these people uniting to tell a story which, to me, was a story of fragility, risk and bravery. And what we're looking at now is the fragility and the risk. And the flags are part of that. You know, they're part of an announcement. They're part of a marking of territory. And the British media is full of people who are either pretending to love it or who actually love it. Or, in some ways, the worst of the worst, the people pretending not to understand what's actually going on. And Gary Neville is not one of them. I'll say again, in the same way that some of my callers feel the need, if they've got brown skin, to say, I've never claimed benefits, I've never done this, I've never done that. And I will say again that, of course, not every flag is racist. That's ridiculous. Not everybody who reveres the flag is racist. That's ridiculous. But the people undertaking this campaign, you tell me why they're doing it. Who drives down that road and feels prouder of being British than they did when they left the house that morning? I'll wait.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why this staggering level of incompetence?
Straight to the point.
This is the economics of the madhouse from this government.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
But she does seem to struggle with her sums.
Listen on Global Player or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Hey, it's me, your dishwasher. I'm sorry about the chaos last night. I think a fork got jammed in my racks. Whoops. Don't even check the bills. I've overdone it. Don't get mad, okay, but I used up lots of power yesterday. Sometimes you just have to blow off some steam.
It can feel like all your energy does is take, take, take. But the longer you're with OVO, the more rewards you get. OVO, do energy differently. Beyond customers only, eligibility required, redemption limits apply.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October. 2 days of big deals on electronics, home, kitchen and more. That'll make you feel less like... and more like... feel like a big deal. Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October. Exclusively for Prime members. Join Prime now.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC with James O'Brien. Text 84850.
11:49 is the time. I mentioned Dear England a moment ago, which, of course, was the opening line of the letter that Gareth Southgate wrote to the country after seeing some of his young charges as England manager exposed to absolutely hideous racism. In fact, you know, if historians of the future want to track the direction of traffic in this country back towards 1970s attitudes, then I suspect that footballers and the taking of the knee would be one of the key milestones on that path. Quite how anyone could have got angry about it still eludes me, unless, of course, they were just sort of saying the quiet part out loud by accident. But I remember when fans started booing it, and people would pretend that that wasn't an expression of anything other than racism. What are you doing? I'm showing solidarity with black people. Okay, I'm going to boo that. Oh, here's a Daily Telegraph article about why it's ridiculous to accuse these people booing of racism. Huh? Okay. But a few of you are reminding me of another thing. Not Dear England, but This Is England, which is the Shane Meadows movie from, good Lord, it's 18 years ago. Good Lord, I watched it about a fortnight ago, actually, and it's brilliant. It's an absolutely superb film. First time we saw Thomas Turgoose on our screens, and a very early performance from Stephen Graham, who has, of course, gone on to conquer the world. But if you watch that film all the way to the end, you'll come away enlightened and refreshed, I think. But you have to watch it all the way to the end. That's This Is England, a beautiful, beautiful piece of filmmaking. 10 to 12 is the time. Back to the flags. Gary Neville wants to know why now. And I kind of want to know what you think they're supposed to do. What are they for? Hearing people saying that make me proud, and then other people saying there was a bloke round our way was putting one up and he's wearing a balaclava helmet. Or here's two fellas who are doing it in some part of the country, but they won't give their surnames to the journalist who's interviewing them. So what is it exactly? And this from Margaret really stopped me in my tracks, actually, because it seemed to me to sum up quite a lot of what we're trying to articulate. There's a man on the bus wearing a Union Jack t-shirt, James, with the message, "If this flag offends you, I'll help you pack." Of course, the flag didn't offend me, but the message sure did. Anne's in Cheltenham. Anne, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Hello. First of all, I'm a first-time caller like Patrick, and I'd like to thank you for all you do to keep us sane.
That's very kind. Thank you, Anne.
I sound a bit nervous because my heart is beating really fast.
It's only me. We'll be fine.
just wanted to say, I experienced the flags flying on a drive from Cheltenham, to where my daughter lives, to Queen's Hospital in Romford.
Okay.
So we had to go through Epping and into Romford to the hospital. And a number of flags. We just felt, as children of Irish immigrants, my husband and I came over in the 50s to help in the NHS, we felt intimidated and sick, and it was stomach churning to see all these flags, the number of them. And then the irony was, of course, you go into the hospital, visit the relative, and who's on the ward? A Polish nurse assistant, and nurses with Asian background, with African background, all doing the work, helping our relatives to get better. And I thought, they have to drive home at night through those streets. And what message is that flag giving to them? Especially the St. George's cross. That was up more than the Union Jack. And I just felt it was intimidating, and it is meant to scare people, and we felt quite scared. And my son-in-law is Asian, right, and he has to drive that way quite often, and he feels quite intimidated by it now.
Most people getting in touch with me do as well. I wonder, you've touched on something really interesting, the tipping point. So if I went out now and put up one flag, it would not have the impact that you've just described. But there's something about the volume of that does two things. It adds to that air of intimidation, and it makes a complete mockery of the idea that anybody is doing this for reasons of patriotism or pride.
Oh, no, yeah. It's definitely done to emphasise the point, to show their support for the likes of Farage. I don't call him Farage, Farage. and Daily Mail propaganda.
And the idea that you can't be British if you're brown, and then, of course, it'll be, you know, give it a couple of years, and it'll be you can't be British if you've got an apostrophe in your name, or you can't be British if you've got family that came over from Ireland. And you know, this book has been written a million times, and yet some people either don't heed its warnings or they welcome the latest recycling of it. And thank you, for your kind words as well. Was everything all right? I don't know what the trip to hospital was for.
She's been looked after, yes, but again, because of the care and attention and dedication of people from diverse backgrounds.
Yes, well, I've got a horrible feeling that situation is going to get worse, not better, I think, as it becomes clearer and clearer that people who have been welcome here for generations are no longer welcome from the kind of people, some of the people who Gary Neville is talking about in his speech about the flags that he encountered on a relatively short journey from to Salford City. As Anne says, it's something about the volume, the numbers, 50 or 60 flags down Bury New Road. What's that about? Why? I love the flag. Okay, put one up in your garden. Don't put one up in my garden. Put one up on your street. Don't put 50 up on somebody else's street. Because if you're doing that, there's something else going on. There's something else going on. John's in Leeds. John, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. Thank you for taking my call. And the last time I spoke to you was about knees and backs, old man syndrome stuff. But this is completely different. This has triggered me. And first of all, I want to say well done to Gary Neville for putting his finger on the pulse. For being courageous, emotionally intelligent, and brave in saying what he needed to say. Just like the woman before you, and you probably recognise my accent, I'm from Northern Ireland. Yeah. And it triggered me. I rode down my son's road to look after his dogs, and there was a load of flags on both sides, St. George's flags and the Union Jack. And the Union Jack that triggers me more than the St. George's flag, because that was the one that, when I went to college in Derry, that was a record beside me. So it triggered me. And I think I'm a fish that's not meant to be caught in this net.
Yeah.
I think it's aimed at black people, Pakistan people, Indian people, you know, any other foreigners that's not that white. I think the reason that he's doing it is the reason they're putting up the flags is because conditions have been created to make it so.
Yes, it's a boiling frog exercise, isn't it? Things that were, as I keep referring back to the Sun calling Nigel Farage racist, words that he said on this programme in 2014, racism pure and simple. And now, when Keir Starmer does it, the same corners of the media have a collective hissy fit. It's extraordinary how far the dialogue has shifted towards racism.
It is, yeah. It's acceptable. It's acceptable to say the unacceptable things.
It's not quite acceptable to say the unacceptable things, but you can go and put loads of flags up in the middle of the night in order to demonstrate the fact that you're thinking the unsayable things.
That's right. And then the question is, how do you respond to this? Not react to it, how do you respond to it? And I think that's the key. That's what we really need to put our heads together and think about what sort of response is there. I know people have responded in different ways, but the response is important as well.
Yeah, it is. And you know, Gary should not be falling to Gary Neville any more than some of the other positions he's adopted over the last few years, should have been falling to Gary Lineker to provide some form of rallying point or leadership on these kind of issues. I'm probably being unfair. I'm sure that people like Zach Polanski at the Green Party and others have been very outspoken about this as well, but of course they don't get the coverage. You got to be Gary Neville to get the kind of newspaper coverage that he's getting today. And that's part of the problem as well. That's part of the sort of collective gaslighting. John, thank you for that. The time is approaching 11:59. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Tony's in Birmingham, which will probably be the last word on this. Tony, what would you like to say?
Hiya, James. You all right?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, I know you haven't got long, so I'll be quick. But just to your question, I think I might have the answer. I think it's more to do with because the English public have got solidarity to the Palestinian flag because of all the marches. Mm. I think the right wing basically getting the English public to pick a side. Now, if you choose the Palestinian not English, you're not patriotic.
Really?
I think this is because you're saying why now? Yeah. And I think because of all the protests and a lot of the public are showing Palestinian flags and showing solidarity to the Palestinian flags, I think the right wing is saying, wait a minute, how come you're flying these flags and not flying the English flag?
Well, you can't show solidarity with the people in Gaza by flying an English flag.
Well, there you go. So they're showing, so the ones that are saying that.
I understand your point. I understand your point.
Don't forget, the right wing is saying that flying the flag, you're a Hamas supporter. You're a supporter of Hamas. You're a supporter of terrorists.
Well, some people on the right wing are saying that. I mean, I've one flaw in your theory, Tony, and that's all it is. You could be right, is that the anti-Semitism on the right wing, on the far right, is absolutely hideous. It might not be front and centre at the moment, but historically it runs through them like Blackpool through a stick of rock. But of course, I suppose, you know, if you're in the business of division, then facts and history don't really matter. But I don't personally see it like that. I know you support what Gary Neville had to say, but I don't personally see that the Palestinian situation playing a particularly big role in this process, in this idea. I could be wrong. I just don't see it currently. It's just gone 12 noon. Speaking of the Green Party and Zach Polanski, they've got a very interesting policy about landlords.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, the Shadow Chancellor has told the Conservative Conference that theirs is the party of opportunity, aspiration and achievement. Samuel Stride's speech included a promise to cut nearly £50 billion in government costs if it wins the next election. The Conservatives say it'll be funded by cuts to public spending in areas including welfare and the foreign aid budget. Speaking in Manchester, Samuel also set out plans to reward work by giving young people a tax rebate.
When someone takes their first job, the first £5,000 they pay in national insurance won't go to the taxman. It will go towards a deposit on their first home, or it will go towards savings for their later life.
Mediators are due to meet in Egypt for indirect talks between Israel and Hamas aimed at ending the war in Gaza. The latest diplomatic efforts come after Hamas agreed to parts of a plan put forward by President Trump. The French President Emmanuel Macron is searching for his sixth prime minister since the start of last year. Sébastien Lecornu has resigned ahead of a no-confidence vote. He only took on the role last month. One of the victims of the Nottingham attacks has been awarded the George Medal for Bravery. Student Grace O'Malley Kumar tried to defend her friend Barnaby Webber when they were both fatally stabbed in 2023. The 19-year-old is one of 20 recipients of the Civilian Gallantry Awards and one of four awarded it posthumously. And the author Dame Jilly Cooper has died at the age of 88. Her family say she passed away yesterday morning after a fall. 11 million copies of her books were sold in the UK during a career lasting more than 50 years. The actress Catherine Parkinson recently starred in the TV adaptation of Cooper's romance novel Rivals and told LBC it was an honour to be involved.
My mum was a huge fan, but I think I was too... I read Mills and Boone, but I was too embarrassed to openly read Jilly Cooper in front of my dad, and I really wish I had back then, because I've read her since and feel like I could have done with Jilly Cooper in my life. I've got to know her writing since, and, you know, she's amazing, and I think the world she creates is amazing.
In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 4.94.86. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloudy but dry for most. Rain in northern areas with sunny spells developing in the southeast. Highs of 19 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 4 minutes after 12, and here's a headline to which I think everybody's going to react very, very calmly. The Green Party has committed itself to abolishing landlords. A word on the Green Party, if I may. He's doing very well. I don't want to invoke the curse of O'Brien, which seems to strike any politician about who I find myself saying warm words. I'm not a particularly well-informed student of the new leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski, but I admire his social media game, or at least what I've seen of it. And I as I get older, I'm doing the opposite of what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to have your opinions ossify, aren't you, as you get older, and possibly even move a little bit to the right. I am not a radical person. Never have been. Would once have said, never will be. I probably am the kind of person that people like Trump and Farage are talking about when they say radical left, because I don't like racism, and I think we probably need a bit slightly fairer distribution of wealth. That seems to be what it means in their world, radical left. I'm certainly not a Marxist, although I would quite like to see public ownership of some more essential utilities. But I'm not a radical, and I don't know whether that's because of my class, my upbringing, my genetic inheritance, or my personality. What I mean when I say that is I've always presumed that if there were brilliant solutions to long-standing problems, then they would already have been found. And tried. Now, I know that makes me sound a bit daft, not least because proper Marxism has arguably never been tried, to coin a phrase. But I just find myself, I think, a little bit... I don't know if it's too, because this might be the right position to be in. But I find myself glued, as it were, to the status quo. I find myself wary of radical change. And I mean proper policy-driven radical change. I don't just mean sort of populist leaders promising the earth without any explanation whatsoever of how they deign to deliver it. So I've had the pleasure this year of interviewing both Bernie Sanders from the United States of America and, I met, as I mentioned a moment ago, the former Greek finance minister, with whom I certainly don't agree about everything, Yanis Varoufakis. And I just think it's given me a little bit of a wobble in terms of noticing that I am a little bit wary of really big ideas. I kind of think the way to change things is incrementally. I think I lean more towards tweaking and honing and improving. Do you see what I mean? And that is me being gaslit by the media environment that I spend most of my professional life castigating and criticizing. I think I've been a little bit, oh no, we can't try that. That sounds far too radical. That would scare the horses. That's a great phrase, isn't it? That would scare the horses. And I'm looking at this suggestion from the Green Party, and I'm sort of thinking, well, go on then. Why not? Because if you think of the country as a pond, And oddly enough, I suppose we were talking about pond life in much of the last hour. But if you think of the country as a pond, and you're really, really unhappy with the state of the pond, we are united pretty much in our belief that the pond could be in much better shape than he actually is, then the bigger the rock that you throw into the pond, the bigger the disruption and possible improvement, the bigger the difference it will make. It's a rather good line from Romina. We can't sensible our way out of this chaos. So for a variety of reasons, some of them self-inflicted, some of them over which we had no control, the country is in a bit of a state, you know. I speak as the man who wrote the best-selling book, How They Broke Britain. And the people that broke it are, as we discussed in the last hour, currently really having a drink in the Last Chance Saloon, and it's a saloon called racism. Let's get them to blame it all on foreigners and immigrants and asylum seekers. All the mess we've made, all the money that we've trousered, all the crony contracts, the VIP lanes, the austerity, all of that, the Brexit, the imposing economic sanctions on ourselves, promising the earth and delivering nothing, promising to get rid of foreigners and having to actually end up inviting more here to fill the enormous holes in the workforce that we created by telling the other ones to clear. Stop blaming. You can't blame me. Even though I cheered it all, let's just blame it all on the foreigners. So that is happening. That's not well, it's not new, but it's a very big rock, as we can see. The ripples are growing. Throw that rock into the pond of community, and you have no control over what happens next. So I read this story, and I caught myself doing what I always would do. Let me read it to you. The Green Party has committed itself to abolishing landlords. That's in quotes. Party members at its conference in Bournemouth yesterday passed a motion that makes seeking the effective abolition of private landlordism official policy. Tenants would be given first right to buy when a landlord sells, with their total rent paid discounted, and government-backed financing provided. Councils would be given second right to buy. I mean, what's your gut reaction to that? Because I caught myself doing the status quo thing, doing the sensible, being sensible, Captain Sensible. I sort of thought, don't be ridiculous, that's outrageous, that couldn't possibly work, that's a madness, that way absolute insanity lies. You're going to, if I, what? Starting when? So if I'm a buy-to-let landlord and I want to sell the house, then not only do I have to offer it to my tenant first, but I have to knock off the price of the house, all the money that they've already paid in rent. Are you having a laugh? Have you gone stark staring, Matt? Yeah, but I'm not a buy-to-let. And then you sort of imagine, if the Green Party assume the sort of momentum that they are currently displaying, you sort of find yourself wondering, I mean, this is going to scare the horses. But are we 100% sure that it's bonkers? Carla Denyer, the Green MP for Bristol Central, sought to play down the new policy, saying, while the motion to confidence had an eye-catching name, it does not actually abolish landlords. It kind of does, because who would want to be a landlord if it's not really the point that you have to offer it to your tenant first? It's the fact that your tenant automatically gets all the rent they've paid knocked off the price of the house. There goes your profit, isn't it? So, I'm not going to lie to you, right? My first reaction to this is, you are bonkers. You're all bonkers. And then my second reaction, and this is what I mean about being slightly surprised by, I mean, look at those two reactions straight in. Well, that's my vote going to a different party, says Martin, whereas Karen says, I punch the air and say, yes, please, I'd vote for that. That's got phone-in written all over it, hasn't it? Come on, what do you need? So my first reaction, hand on heart, and don't hate me for it, I was a landlord for a while, and I was an accidental landlord, but I mean, I put a house that we failed to sell before we moved into the next one into the hands of a local housing association, so I got less money than I would have got had I rented it out privately, but it still covered the mortgage, so, you know, I was having my home paid for by somebody else. I wasn't particularly comfortable with it, but when I look back and I think of my children's future, there are times when I think, oh, you should have hung on to that, because it would be going up in value every year for doing absolutely nothing while the people living in it are paying off your mortgage. Oh, that's insane, right? Just think about it. Oh, they can't afford to buy a house. They are buying a house. Your children are currently buying a house, but they're buying it for their landlord. They are not buying it for themselves. So there is a madness to this status quo. But then the other half of me kicks in. So the first half kicks in and says, you've all gone mad. You're all bonkers. And then the other bit of me goes, well, what? And this is as far as it goes, all right? Don't laugh at me. Laugh with me, please. What if they're not? So that's your phone in, right? You're absolutely bonkers on the one hand. What if you're not on the other? And also, who am I to know? Just because something is outlandish and hasn't been tried before, what would be the best example of something that everybody thought was bonkers until it happened and it turned out to be brilliant? The NHS? I give you the NHS. And Nairin Bevin essentially faced so much opposition that he eventually just said, right, we're doing it on Tuesday. We're doing it on Tuesday, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. Even his own Prime Minister, was it Attlee, was unconvinced. But Bevin was a visionary. He was a one-off. He said, right, we're doing it. And you know what his logic was? His logic was pretty straightforward. In the Welsh mining town where he grew up, the subs that would be paid by the working miners meant that everybody got healthcare, including their children and their wives and people who weren't working. People who were taking industrial action would still get healthcare. So he took the model of this relatively small Welsh mining village and thought, why can't we do that for the whole country? And you know what the big radio phone-in hosts of the time said? There weren't any big radio phone-in hosts. I'm doing a bit of theatre of the mind. They said, you're bonkers, Bevin! Bonkers Bevin, they called him. Bevan. Bonkers Bevan. I don't know if they did, but he faced extraordinary resistance to this. Do you know who was at the front of the queue of people telling him he was bonkers? The British Medical Association. So the people working in health didn't want it. The political establishment didn't really want it. He just did it. So, what if they're not bonkers? What if they're not bonkers? Here's what would happen. Tenants would be given first right to buy when a landlord sells, and their total rent paid so far would be knocked off the asking price. There'd be government-backed financing provided, like a government-backed mortgage. And if the tenant didn't want to buy it, this is a currently rented home. It's not your main home. Don't worry about that. Then the council would get second dibs. They'd have rent controls, they'd get rid of right to buy, and they'd get rid of buy-to-let mortgages. Landlords were described in the motion as adding, quote, no positive value to the economy or society. And further, the, quote, relationship between landlord and tenant is inherently and intrinsically extractive and exploitative. So I've got two questions for you. The first is, what if they're not bonkers? 03456060973. And the second is, what would actually happen if this came in? Because I haven't got a Scooby-Doo. What would actually happen? I'm thinking if I was a landlord and they brought this rule in, then I don't think they'd be allowed to retrospectively knock the rent off the asking price. They could only do it from the moment they brought the law in, couldn't they? So some people would end up owed money by their landlords. Think about that. If you're struggling with those words, exploitative and extractive, some people would be owed money by their landlords if they moved out tomorrow under this rule. You'd have paid so much rent over the course of your life that not only had you covered the cost of the house, you had some left over for lunch. And your landlord, I don't think, would have to give it back to you. So you couldn't do it retrospectively. That would just be absolute insanity. So starting on Monday, when we assume power, the rent you pay to your landlord will get knocked off the price you pay to buy the house when he decides or she decides to put it on the market. So what are you going to do straight away? Day one, you're going to put it on the market. You want to get rid of it as quickly as you possibly can, because every month of rent is getting knocked off the asking price of the house when you find... So I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud, what would happen? So there it is. Those are the three points of the triangle. Point one, this is absolutely bonkers. Point two, what if it's not bonkers? And point three, what would actually happen? And you can answer one, two, or three of those questions right now by dialing 03456060973. You'd be take it as seriously as you want, actually, because I think it deserves a bit of seriousness, but it also lends itself perhaps to a little bit of silliness. We are going to abolish landlords. Final line, I promise. It's a superb scene in A Very British Coup. The book was written by Chris Mullins, a Labour MP. The screenplay was written by Alan Plater, starring Ray McAnally as a very sort of old school socialist who actually gets into Downing Street. And the train, I haven't told you this for years, this is like my politics in a nutshell, or it was when I was a kid. The train is pulling out of the platform, I think at Leeds Station or somewhere. And the journalists are all gathered trying to trip him up. Say, is it true? Is it true you're going to abolish first-class travel? And he leans out of the train window and he goes, no, I'm going to abolish second-class travel. So, what's not to like? It's 12:18.
This is LBC.
Now I'm 53. I've been smoking for nearly 40 years. That's a long time to smoke. I'm really proud of myself. Really, really proud of myself. It's a big thing to give up smoking, a really, really big thing. And actually now, I'm nearly a year smoke-free. My family are very proud of me too, and that's important.
One U Surrey can provide the help you need to stop smoking, including quitting aids, online support with a trained mentor, and one-to-one sessions. And it's all free. With support, you can do it. For more information, visit oneusurrey.org.uk. Stopping smoking. It's well worth it.
Never too late. Absolutely never too late to give up smoking.
The advert looked genuine. A post from a household name, experts in money, a hot opportunity. They asked for a small amount, promised a great return, took all I had, and then disappeared. Investment scammers are highly sophisticated, and every month CEL talk to thousands of people like you who've fallen victim. Our experts can help recover your money. So head to celsolicitors.co.uk today.
CEL.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
Just like when you amplify your advertising with radio. 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
20 minutes after 12 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Don't get cross. Maybe they could do it so that all of the rent you've ever paid would be applicable from day one. I just don't think you'd get that through. I mean, that would be carnage, really. But the plan is to give first dibs on a house sale to the tenant when a landlord puts it on the market, and all the rent you've paid would be knocked off the price of the house. I'm just presuming that could only be enacted with rent paid after the point that the law was introduced. But I don't know that they actually did clarify it or specify. So feel free to attack either or to applaud either proposal. The idea is that you would abolish landlords, and I want to know what would actually happen if this kicked in. And we got some extraordinary responses already. Quick word to Peter, who sent me a lovely message. I did indeed meet your son on Saturday in Oxford, Peter, and I hope you're very, very proud of him, because you certainly should be. But thank you for the kind words that you've sent to me. I appreciate that. Said I don't know any other way to contact you, so I'm texting the show. And give my regards to Will. 21 minutes after 12 is the time. Paul is in Norwich. Are you a football fan, Paul?
I am, James, but I'm trying to keep quiet about football.
Yeah, sorry, mate. That was a tough one. It was bad enough losing to Peterborough, but at least they're not our sworn and historical rivals. But anyway,
don't worry. I'm not Norwich supporter. I'm a Burnley supporter.
Oh, Lord. Worse, mate, crikey. We all have our crosses to bear. Anyway, what's going on? What's going to happen? Is it bonkers?
I'm not going to go as far as bonkers. I don't think it's a very good idea, James. I'll be polite about it.
Fair enough.
Because the rental sector is made up of a wide range of people. A lot of people don't want a mortgage, aren't fit to have a mortgage because of their circumstances being erratic income streams all over the place.
Yeah, but the second bit would see it going to the council. So it would essentially, I presume, and I'm not here to represent the Green Party or the policy, but it would represent a shifting of ownership from private sector back to public sector.
So the council's, where they're going to get this money from?
Details, Paul, details. They'll be able to get a mortgage like everybody else, wouldn't they?
Well, the council, the council get a mortgage.
Yeah, they will. I mean, you could borrow a ton of money, buy a ton of houses, and then pay back the money with the rent that you're getting on the...
Where would the council borrow it from?
Well, the Halifax. Next question.
You're not winning on this one, John. No, I mean, seriously, you know, renters, a lot of people aren't able to get a mortgage, don't want a mortgage, their circumstances are erratic.
Yes.
And if a landlord then sold the property...
Hang on a minute,
We've got a tenant here that's in a landlord property, the landlord says, I'm going to sell the property.
Yeah.
Okay, first dibs to the tenants, we can't or don't want to buy it.
Yeah.
Second dibs to the council, either way, that property gets sold. Where do the tenants live who were living in that property? Who houses them now? Halifax. Is that going to be your answer to everything, James, and not Northern Rock to get the mortgages?
Yeah, where do the tenants go is the problem here.
Who houses them if all landlords...
Okay, no, I'm going to have an in-good-faith crack at this, right?
Go on.
Because what you've done is you've distilled it down to the permanent renter.
That was another point I was going to say. Not everybody, a lot of people are transient renters.
But you've distilled it down to the person who will always be renting for whatever reason, who does not dream of property ownership. So let's address that then. So first dibs to the tenant. That ain't going to happen in this case. Mm-hmm. Second dibs to the council. That ain't going to happen as often. I mean, it's not going to happen every single time because, as you quite rightly point out, they haven't got the spondulics. So then third option is it will go to the open market, where it will be bought by people who are currently being either priced out of the market or squeezed out by supply and demand problems. Tenant. Where does the tenant go? The tenant moves into properties that are owned by landlords who deal exclusively with the tenants you opened your contribution by describing, the ones that will never, ever be able to buy a house, so they've got nothing to worry about when they come to sell it.
Yeah, but if you've abolished landlords, the landlords are not there, are they?
That's a figure of speech. The only landlords that will remain...
That's what they said, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's not... You can't abolish landlords. That's like abolishing cheese. It's always going to exist.
That's what they said.
Carl Adenia said that there is... let me get it right. Carla Denny said that's not what it actually means, even if that's what it said in the rubric. But stop spoiling my theory. So the only landlords who would be left are the landlords who rent to people who will never want to buy.
And why would they want to remain in the market, these landlords?
Because they're going to get money every month.
Well, yeah, but they're always under constant threat because people want them to be extinct.
But they're not under constant threat because they're only renting to people who will never be able to buy the houses. So when they want to sell them...
We want to get rid of landlords.
No, but you can't keep coming back to the rhetoric as opposed to the very carefully worked out technical detail that I've just treated you to exclusively on LBC.
Yeah. Go on, you're a policy maker for the Green Party.
So here's what she said. The motion to confidence had an eye-catching name, but it does not actually abolish landlords. So that's you dealt with by Carla Denyer, the Green MP for Bristol Central. That's you back in your box. We're not abolishing landlords.
It doesn't do what it says on the tin.
No, it doesn't. They're getting rid of loads of them, and the only ones that will be left, as you have unintentionally identified, are the ones who will only be renting to people who have no particular hopes of...
Are they going to be in the minority or the majority? If they're in a minority,
you've got an
increasing housing crisis, haven't you?
Yeah, listen, I'm not here to defend it. I'm the one that said bonkers. You were too polite to even say that. And yet you've gone much further than I have in criticising it. 12:26 is the time. 03456060973 is the number. I got one of my favourite Trump clips of all time to play to you, but we're reaching the point now where it's not funny. So, you know, as you see the sort of armed people snatching innocents off the street, Trump trying to send troops into cities where everything is fine, but he's pretending there's war. He's getting, you know, the path towards the F word is gathering pace all the time. And then we play out the clips of him sounding like an absolute Herbert. At some point, it's not going to be funny at all. But I don't think we've reached that point yet. So stand by for the latest example of his Herbertry. Matthew is in Woking. Matthew, what would you like to say?
Hello, James.
Hello.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said they couldn't bring it in. You couldn't bring it in retrospectively.
No.
It would have to be like, from a certain day, this will be legislation, this will happen. So what I believe then, if they, let's just follow the course, what would then happen was thousands of landlords would go, right, I need to dump this property because I've had these tenants for so long, it would cost me, you know, I'd end up have to sell this house for, say, half the price I would on the open market if this legislation comes in. So landlords would then start dumping properties onto the market. And at the moment, we've got a housing bubble, as you know. That's why our houses are worth, you know, ridiculously more than they are. You know, I live in Woking, and my house, if you took my house, picked it up, took it to Wales, it would probably be worth like a quarter of the price, for example.
Yes.
So you're not paying for bricks and mortar, you're paying for the housing bubble.
Location, location, location.
Location, exactly. So if landlords started dumping the properties on the market, I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm just saying it's pure economics. The housing bubble would burst, house prices would start dropping, and it would be a buyer's rather than a seller's market for a change.
Yeah, but what about all the people who need the equity in their house for their retirement or who are banking on it for their, their futures?
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a good or a bad thing. I'm just saying
that's what would happen.
You asked what would happen.
I did.
That will happen as sure as eggs are eggs. That would happen. The housing bubble would burst. And landlords would be desperate to sell, and they'd be, you know, undercutting each other. And
just take it off my hands. But so that wouldn't last for very long, though.
No, but the housing. But once it bursts, I mean, there's several books about our housing bubble. It is a bubble, you know. As I said, my house in another part of the country wouldn't be worth.
No, I understand all of that. I understand all of that.
We do live in a bubble. So once you prick that bubble, where's it going to end?
Well, I mean, ideally, to unprick your bubble, if that's a thing, ideally the councils would be taking up an awful lot of the abandoned, an awful lot of the sold properties, and I don't think it's pie in the sky to suggest that they could fund that through through loans. So the councils will buy loads of houses as they are vacated. They will become social housing. And the people paying rent for social housing will essentially be helping the council buy the property.
Where would councils get their money from to buy all this housing?
The Halifax. I've told you, the Halifax.
We are. we are millions of pounds in debt because of the terrible council we had.
Yes, well, it could be worse. It could be worse. Have you seen what's happened in? Oh, I've lost it now. I hate it when this happens. One of the reform councils that said it was going to come in and save tons of money because it was all being wasted on the things that the Daily Mail told them it was being wasted on. Have you seen what's happened in Kent?
No, I haven't.
Kent's local authority is likely to raise council tax rates next year as Reform UK has struggled to find big savings under its Elon Musk-inspired cost-cutting drive. it actually gets better. There's a line in it about how when we came in, we thought there was going to be loads of stuff. Everyone thought we'd come in, said a senior Reform cabinet member, and there were going to be these huge costs we could cut away, but there just aren't. So, yeah, I mean, they could borrow the money. I don't know, at preferential rates from the Bank of England. Spoiler alert, I don't know what I'm talking about. It's 12:30. Amelia Cox has got your headlines.
The Shadow Chancellor has told his party's conference that the Conservatives are the party of opportunity, aspiration and achievement. Samuel Stride has promised to cut almost £50 billion in public spending if they win the next election. Indirect talks between Israel and Hamas are due to take place in Egypt. The latest efforts to end the war in Gaza comes after Hamas agreed to parts of a plan put forward by President Trump. And the author Dame Jilly Cooper has died at the age of 88 following a fall. During a career lasting more than 50 years, she sold more than 11 million copies of her books. LBC weather, mostly cloudy in the north with outbreaks of rain and strong winds for northwest Scotland. Dry in the south, sunnier in the southeast. A warmer day for many with highs of 19 degrees.
LBC.
Okay, train from London to peaceful Peterborough.
Ning Park this way, huh?
Gorgeous, wow. Never thought I'd be this into bird watching.
Did you see it? Lovely plumage.
Train home. Brilliant day. Oh, gotta rent bikes next time to see the big lake. And more birds, obviously.
Download the Thameslink Railway app and save with advanced tickets. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply, see our website for full details.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. for each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest, you probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
When you're smiling,
don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
Mickey could try to sell his car privately. Or get it sold today with We Buy Any Car. He could spend days on end trying to sell to a bunch of time wasters. Or sell in a flash and head to the fun fair with the kids. Proper gutted. Or proper impressed. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
12:33 is the time. I think I owe you an apology. I told you that I was going to share with you all 10 of the interesting things about Mel Stride that have been circulated at the Conservative Party conference this morning in anticipation of his speech. I didn't actually fall asleep, but I just couldn't keep it up. He's a licensed pilot and scuba diver, apparently. But does he like fast catamaran sailing? That's what we really want to know. He started with chemistry when he went to university and then switched to PPE. Okay. His parents left school early. He went to school in Portsmouth. Well, okay, that's quite nice. He starts most days with an early morning wild swim. And he's a qualified tour guide for some of Britain's greatest landmarks. I quite like that as well. But anyway, there it is. Goodness knows what they rejected as being too dull. 12:34 is the time. I don't know quite what you're going to make of this, but I need to keep showing you. Because do you remember, and I still think it was the right thing to do. It's one of the great tensions of political discourse, isn't it? Is that if you're, or if you try to be honest and evidence-based when the other people aren't, you end up helping the other people sometimes. So I think it was correct to cover Joe Biden's clear cognitive decline. I think it was impossible not to after that debate where he really lost his thread on a number of occasions. But my goodness me, it would be nice if people who were cheering for Donald Trump at the time would demonstrate the same ability to be objective and clear-eyed with their own guy that many people on the other side of the aisle in US politics demonstrated with Joe Biden. Because this is now normal in the United States of America.
I don't want to be politically correct anymore. And history will never forget that it was the SEALs who stormed the compound at Osama bin Laden and put a bullet in his head. Remember that. And please remember I wrote about Osama bin Laden exactly 1 year ago, 1 year before he blew up the World Trade Center. And I said, you got to watch Osama bin Laden. And the fake news would never let me get away with that statement unless it was true. But I said 1 year before to Pete Hegseth, I said 1 year before, where's Pete? In the book I wrote, whatever the hell the title, I can't tell you. But I can tell you there's a page in there devoted to the fact that I saw somebody named Osama bin Laden and I didn't like it and you got to take care of him. They didn't do it. A year later, he blew up the World Trade Center, so we got to take a little credit because nobody else is going to give it to me. You know the old story? They don't give you credit, just take it yourself. And it was the U.S. Navy that dumped his wretched corpse off the decks of the Carl Vinson to sink into the dark abyss.
Okay. That's all very, very normal. I mean, who here hasn't written a book that they've forgotten the title of, even though it contains such an extraordinary revelation? And that's all going on. And I mean it, you know, it's reaching the point where it won't be funny anymore. I don't think we've quite reached it yet, but goodness me, it's not far off on the horizon, is it? Do you know what his actual response to the World Trade Center attack was? His genuine response was to reflect upon the fact that a building he owned was now the tallest in New York. All the things you look back on and think, God, there's no way that guy could ever be president. Imagine responding to the September the 11th terror attacks. So just likes of which the world had never seen. And his earliest recorded response, as far as I'm aware, was to claim that he now had once again the tallest building in New York. 12:37 is the time. Alex is in Worcester. Alex, what would you like to say?
Good afternoon, James. I was just calling in because I am one of the co-proposers of the abolished landlords motion that was passed at the Green Party conference yesterday.
How many co-proposers are there, Alex, if you don't mind me asking?
I think there was about 30, so I shouldn't take the credit for it.
Well, I'm just trying to decide. I mean, you've probably been alerted to the fact that we're talking about you today, so you won't be aware of some of the furniture on the programme, but I have a special honour that I reserve for people whose qualifications to contribute to a conversation are above reasonable expectations, and I think you've probably crossed that threshold. So you won't understand this, but everybody else listening will.
I'm Ray Liotta, and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. If you build it, they will come.
Sorry, Alex, where were we?
Well, we were just talking about the abolished landlords motion, which has, I think you'll agree, got a memorable title, unlike Donald Trump's book.
Oh, well played. Yes, very much so. So how would it work? I mean, the three questions that everybody else is asking are, is it bonkers? What if it's not bonkers? And what would actually happen were it introduced tomorrow? So I'd push you towards the third question, if I may.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. So although the title of the proposal is abolish landlords, it wouldn't actually abolish them tomorrow. The intention is to abolish them over time. So the things it would bring in would be things like rent controls and abolishing right to buy so that we're not selling off more of our council houses. It would end Section 21 evictions, otherwise known as no-fault evictions, and make all rental agreements long-term tenancies. It would bring in taxes for landlords on land values, so they pay a fair tax for the amount of property that they own. It would end buy-to-let mortgages, so there wouldn't be any further expansion of
which is probably one of the most easily understandable insidious examples of exploitation, because people who can actually afford to buy a home are buying it for somebody else, because what they haven't got is the capital lump sum or the deposit needed to get their own names on the deeds instead of their landlord's names. So, I mean, to be clear then, the idea is to make being a landlord unsustainable so that they all choose not to be landlords anymore.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, we were in a state in the early 70s where I think just 7% of the housing market was rentals, and that's essentially where we're seeking to get back to, where the option, so most people when they're leaving home have the option of moving into a council home or something similar, or buying their own home so that they're not stuck living with their parents and not able to move into their own home.
So what about the danger of a bubble bursting and everybody who has toiled away for decades to get equity in their own home sees the value of their house plummet because the market is flooded with the properties owned by soon to be abolished landlords?
Well, I think the general what we've seen in the housing market is that housing prices, that doesn't generally happen. When there have been bubbles, it's been because people have been easily able to access finances and buy homes, and then they've fallen when the economy's crashed. So it's not generally been about the housing market, it's about how the general economy's doing.
So I am a landlord. I am selling my house. Oh, just to be clear, would the rent that gets knocked off the price of the property, that would only kick in from the moment the rule was introduced? Or would it go... Yeah, because you can't start... I mean, I might have been living here for 20 years, and that means I'd end up being owed money by my landlord if he finally decided to sell the house. So I'm a landlord. You bring this law in. I fairly quickly decide to put my property on the market. The tenant doesn't fancy it. The council can't afford it.
Yep.
It then gets sold to the people you've just described, who we all want to see getting on the ladder. Where do the tenants go?
Well, so there's actually no requirement if it's being sold that tenants would have to go anywhere. Landlords can currently sell houses and tenants can stay within those houses if that's the choice. I think the bit I would disagree with is the council couldn't afford
to buy it. Then you'd be selling it to another landlord. And we're abolishing landlords, so you can't sell it to another landlord if the writing's on the wall for landlords. You're talking about the tenants get first dibs on it, they can't afford it, the council doesn't buy it for whatever reason, because it's not a green council, And then up come the young couple who are currently being priced out or squeezed out of the market, and the happy days, they can get in. But where do the tenants go? Where are they going to go? They don't want to buy a house. They can't afford to. Their lives are not geared in such a way that makes house purchase possible. They are permanent tenants. Where do they go?
Yeah. Well, so the intention is that there will be a vast increase in the availability of council homes. So they could go onto a council home. I mean, many councils have very long waiting lists at the moment, and many of the former council homes are now owned by landlords and charging market rent. Now, the point I wanted to make is, you mentioned about councils not being able to afford it. In this country, we spend £24 billion a year on paying housing benefit to landlords to house people in homes.
This is true.
And that's a huge amount of money that we can have every year that can be spent on buying assets, i.e. the homes, and transferring them into council control.
So we have
an asset that's appreciating value owned by the state, and people actually have homes that they can live in.
So the tenants would be moving into social housing.
Yeah, exactly.
I like it.
Yeah, I mean, what we're looking to get away with this policy, or get away from with this policy, is the idea that the only way to be secure is to own your own home. You know, the having a warm, secure home should be a human right, and that's what this policy talks about. And secure in the sense of both secure that your property is secure from other people trying to take it, but secure in that you aren't at risk of being made homeless. And we had some information in Worcester that I think 61% of people in private rentals have lived in their homes for less than 3 years.
Crikey.
And over 80% don't want to move within the next 12 months. And I think that shows the
insecurity
that's caused.
Do you know what else you can do? I know Worcester quite well. I don't know if you know that, but the other thing you can do, is say that to insulate yourself against the sort of allegations of being radical communists or whatever it is they'll call you, you're actually just rebalancing, going back to how things used to be, which is quite a helpful tool in the populists' playbook. But on this occasion, it would actually be policy rather than populism. We just want to go back to the division between rental and owner-occupier that was normal in, say, the 1980s or the 1970s.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I think there was a quote from the proposer of the motion that in the early 1970s, there was a Conservative minister, one of those well-known radical Marxists in the Conservative Party, who said that we are looking at the end of the private rental market at that point. And obviously we've moved away from that, but that's a state we can get back to with perfectly sensible policies like this.
I think right to buy would upset quite a lot of people in social housing who actually like the idea of being able to buy it one day, wouldn't it?
I think there's a difference between owning the home and it being your home for life as long as you want to live in it. There's no reason why we couldn't revisit in future and look at right to buy again, but we're in a situation at the moment where vastly more homes have been sold off under right to buy than were built to replace
them. That's very true.
And many of those homes that were sold off under right to buy are now in the hands of private landlords, and that's assets that we built as a country that are now profiting
they're money machines for individuals and some companies. Alex, great stuff, thank you for your time today. I apologize for ambushing you with a Ray Liotta, but somebody else will be able to explain to you what an amazing honor that was.
Thank you very much.
12:45 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC.
LBC's Make Some Noise.
This Friday is Make Some Noise Day, LBC's charity fundraiser helping brilliant projects right across the UK. And right now, you can get involved with an exciting prize. You and one guest could be exclusively joining us behind the scenes here at LBC. You start the day with a coffee and a Q&A with Nick Ferrari. Then you grab your spot in the studio to watch me, James O'Brien, it says here, in action. We'll give you a private tour of the studios here at Global. None of this is compulsory. You can pick and choose which bits you like. So, it's all there like a buffet. We'll give you a private tour of the studios here at Global, from LBC to Heart, Capital, even the Newsagents podcast, before you catch up with Sheila Fogarty and hear about how she puts her show together. Then it's off for a lavish afternoon tea at the Soho House Hotel. And if that's not enough, you'll also get two tickets to see my Full Disclosure podcast live in London on the 19th of February. To enter this competition, text the word studio to 84850. That's studio, S-T-U-D-I-O. And send it to 84850. By entering, you'll have the chance to make a voluntary £10 donation, which will be added to your phone bill. 100% goes to LBC's charity, Make Some Noise. You've got until 4pm on Friday the 10th of October to enter. Standard network rates apply. You must be 18 or over to enter. For full terms and conditions, including prize date restrictions, visit lbc.co.uk. And good luck. Make sure you stay with LBC this Friday for Make Some Noise Day. For more ways to help our fantastic charity.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
The Home Secretary says new legislation will give police more powers to stop protests going ahead. It's going to be tough, and it should be, shouldn't it?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
How will you react if you win big with Win Plus?
I can't believe.
Enter now at winplus.co.uk to get in the draw. 18 plus GB only, T's and C's apply.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
Play Set for Life from the National Lottery. Winners get 10K every month for 30 years. You could win on repeat. Set for Life. Play now on the National Lottery app. Terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Running a ceramic studio is all about balance, right, Nina?
Absolutely. That's why my business deserves the new iPhone 17 Pro. It can help me handle even the busiest workday, from planning my classes to keeping my kiln on track, so my business still holds shape.
The all-new iPhone 17 Pro, as pro as your work demands. Your business deserves the most powerful iPhone on EE, the UK's best network. BT and EE, better for business.
Verify at ee.co.uk/claims.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
12:50 is the time. You have to text it to the word studio to 84850 for that competition. You can't use WhatsApp. It has to be the text to 84850. This is nice from Nina. Hi, James. Would it be possible to just give Patricia Routledge a very quick mention? She passed away 3 days ago, and because of such big events in the news, she barely got a mention anywhere. As you know, she played Hyacinth Bouquet, or Bucket, in Keeping Up Appearances, and was a truly lovely and kind person. I know dedications to the newly deceased are not really your job, but I feel bad for her passing, barely having been marked in the media. Either way. Once again, a really great show today. Thank you for that. And I'm happy to do it. That, not least because it's not just Keeping Up Appearances that she was brilliant in, but also the Alan Bennett monologues that she absolutely bossed. And the reason why Kay sent that was because we took a moment earlier to reflect upon the passing of Dame Jilly Cooper, who you will have probably learned passed away yesterday after a fall, her family have revealed, at the age of 88. And I mentioned an old mucker of mine to whom she was extraordinarily kind at the very beginning of his career. I speak of my former Daily Express colleague Henry Fitzherbert, who was, by anybody's reckoning, the finest gossip columnist of his generation, and indeed mine, but who I was always quite jealous of your relationship with Jilly Cooper, because she really, really looked out for you in the early days, didn't she?
No, it was amazing, James. I'm very, very sad at her passing. Yeah. I was 15 years old, can you believe it? And I was a complete nobody, just a squitty schoolboy. But I had just read Rivals, and it had completely blown my mind. I told my English teacher, Jilly Cooper's the new Jane Austen. and he said, oh, don't talk nonsense. Anyway, I wrote to Jilly Cooper. I explained how much I adored her book. And she then allowed me to come and interview her. And I spent the entire day at her home in Gloucestershire. And she treated me like the most important interviewer in the world. She gave up several hours of her day. Her husband, Leo, cooked me a slap-up lunch. And we gossiped and laughed. And I left feeling, you know, like the most important person on the planet, floating on air. And then 5 years later, James, when I wanted to get into journalism, having just left university, I wrote to her. I said, oh, you won't remember me, but... And she wrote back and said, of course I remember you, Henry. Let me make some introductions for you. And so she is entirely responsible for my career in Fleet Street.
Well, the rest is history. And she was... I mean, when I joined you on the William Hickey column at the Daily Express a couple of years later, she was extraordinarily kind to all of us. I was explaining earlier that when we had to do the ring rounds, the people whose phone numbers had somehow ended up in our sweaty clutches, it would always be the same relatively small number of people, many of whom were incredibly impatient. But Jilly Cooper would always find time to tell you what her favourite biscuit was or whatever nonsense.
Absolutely right. Only a few celebrities were guaranteed to pick up the phone and actually speak to you. And one of them was Jilly, and she'd always give you the most amazing quote. But most of the time she'd ask what the gossip was at your end.
Yes.
She wanted to know what was happening. So she asked as many questions as you asked her, and she was an absolute dear. And any time you wrote about her in the paper, you'd get this lovely handwritten thank you note from her, which was extraordinary. I've got about a dozen of them here.
Pure class, wasn't she? Didn't she try to set you up with her daughter at one point?
Oh, I don't think she was that stupid, no. I have no memory of that, to be honest. But I did meet her daughter, and she was absolutely lovely.
And she would do this not just for you. I think you got the top of the treatment, but all of us would know that when you were phoning her or bumping into her at a party when we had to do those dreadful parties where we had to try to get people to say things to us, she'd always give you a line. She'd always give you, I should explain that for younger listeners, she'd always give you a line for tomorrow's newspaper. it was close to unique, wasn't it? That level of kindness and cooperation.
Unbelievable, and she was always so curious and kind. I don't know any celebrities who are like her.
No, we probably, but she would, I'll tell you what she'd enjoy now, if we were to mention some of the ones that were the polar opposite, but I don't think it would be appropriate. I always remember getting told to F off by one household name when I phoned him up to ask him probably what his favourite biscuit was, but we won't see her again.
She was the quintessential national treasure.
Yeah, she really was, wasn't she? In fact, she came to one of our national treasures lunches, didn't she?
She did, she would always turn up and be very entertaining.
When did you last see her?
Several years ago, I think it was one of her latter book launches. But she always remembered my name. She always and always asked what I was doing. So
lovely stuff. Henry is a screenwriter now, I should add. So journalist turned screenwriter. At the time we're talking about, he was the deputy editor of the William Hickey column on the Daily Express when I was the office boy. Jilly Cooper, as he's explained, helped him get his first break. Henry, take care, mate. I'll see you soon.
Thanks, James. Great to be on.
12:55 is the time. Speaking of showbiz chums. One of my all-time favourite guests on Full Disclosure this week. I've spoken to him a lot on and off air, and I have done a podcast with him before, but not this one, not Full Disclosure. Can you guess who it is?
There's no national procurement system for schools or hospitals or old people's homes.
There just should be.
We could love our farmers much more by having a Ministry of Food that we had in the war.
Yeah.
We haven't got that. It's all like Jobsworth. It's all separate silos of talent. No one's joining the dots of actually... Like the French are quite interesting. I'm not saying they're perfect, but their national health, as in public health, is globally interestingly healthy. And they can consume like higher amounts of salt and fat, sat fats, than us, but they're healthier. They have healthier outcomes. How? Because the whole picture of what they're eating is better, but also culturally, not a law, they have a slower lunch.
Yes.
Right, they fight, and this is one example.
From school onwards.
They have, like, in a factory, working class people will have a long lunch. In schools, they have three courses. Mm. We're now proving in science that eating slowly is more healthy.
Not wolfing something at your desk.
Eating slowly, you can metabolize nutrients in a more efficient way, and they don't get just set in the body as fat straight away. You know, so we're seeing all these, just chewing more, is not just, when you're chewing, it's not just chewing more in the first stage of digestion through your saliva, through amylase, and like, also it's code, chemistry code to your gut. This is coming down the hole.
Incoming.
And then, so, because we're not chewing much, because a lot of processed foods, like, this is why our bodies are in utter chaos.
It's a good one, this. But I'll tell you why, because it's actually a call to arms as well. So his new series, Eating Healthy, and the new book, I mean, are characteristically brilliant. He brought me a cake as well. Do you know I shared it? Did you get any of that cake? No, I didn't get any cake. Sorry about that. It was delicious. But it's also got a website. There's a two-week program you can do to really kickstart what he's describing about a bigger picture of personal health, personal physical diet-based health. And remember what you said about France. Do you remember when we were doing school dinners together and we got sent that menu from a French mum and we couldn't believe our eyes because it simply laid out what every single French child has from their very, very first day at school. And the difference between the French normal and the British normal was absolutely cataclysmic. And that's what he's talking about. So we often think, oh, I can't eat this and I can't eat that. But if you've got a holistic, dreadful word, a holistic approach to your diet, then you can actually do the traditionally perceived as less healthy things, because it's like your bedrock of digestion and nutrition is so much healthier. And he really nails it. He's looking at two things in the new project: basket health, which is the contents of the average basket in this country coming out of a supermarket, and ours is one of the worst in the world, and he's trying to fix it. And I think he's amazing, and it's a really good interview. And if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on Global Player and the LBC app, where you can stay up to date on all the top stories and opinions. You can put your news categories in the order you want. Pause, rewind live radio, but not fast forward, remember, and listen to a range of podcasts. And with the James O'Brien Daily Podcast, you get an hour of the best bits of this show every single day. So download the official LBC app from your app store now and join Tom Swarbrick at 4 on LBC and Sheila Fogarty next. Thank you very much, James. At 3 today, the Tory Party Conference is happening in Manchester. The Shadow Chancellor, Samuel Stride, told LBC today, "We are the grown-up adult party." Are you giving them a hearing? Or are they like a bad ex who still wants to be on your Christmas card list? At 2, Gary Neville on white middle-aged men dividing us as he sees it. We'll talk about that. John Sopel joins me to talk about the Trump-Gaza-Israel peace deal a little later on. We'll discuss whether it will hold, here's hoping. But I'll start with the new plans from the Home Secretary to legislate to give police more powers to stop some protests going ahead for some reasons. It's going to be tough, and it should be. Shouldn't it?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the author Dame Jilly Cooper has died at the age of 88 following a fall. Her family say her death yesterday came as a complete shock. The best-selling writer, who has sold 11 million copies of her books, spoke about the joy of seeing her novel Rivals brought to the TV.
They worked so hard and they just went, they went to the Cotswolds, and there were millions of people at Disney, and they all loved each other. Did you know things like this? Men sort of get jealous of actors, male actors, and women do. They all loved each other. It was such a happy set.
Her agent says she defined culture for more than 50 years, and her work will be remembered for its wit and enduring appeal. The Shadow Chancellor says the Conservatives are the only party which will stand up for fiscal responsibility at its conference in Manchester. Samuel Stride has promised to save almost £50 billion of taxpayers' money through cuts to public spending. He says if the party wins the next general election, they will reduce costs in areas including welfare and the foreign aid budget. Labour says they can't be trusted. Talks between mediators representing Israel and Hamas are taking place in Egypt today. The negotiations will focus on a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages under President Trump's peace plan. A posthumous George Medal is being given to one of the victims of the Nottingham attacks. Grace O'Malley Kumar is receiving the honour for trying to save the life of Barnaby Webber in 2023. LBC's reporter Harry Briggs has more.
The award describes Grace's action as an outstanding example of personal bravery. Prime Minister Keir Starmer's paid tribute, saying her legacy will live on as a powerful example of heroism and that she made the ultimate sacrifice to protect her friend.
And Jaguar Land Rover is expected to restart some of its production in the UK this week. All manufacturing was paused at the end of August after a major cyber attack. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 13 points at 95.04. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather, mostly cloudy in the north with outbreaks of rain and strong winds for northwest Scotland. Dry in the south, sunnier in the southeast. A warmer day for many with highs of 19 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
There's always a lot going on. I'm on site getting the job done, running the business too, payments, invoices, admin, all on me. But now with Tap to Pay, I can take payments there and then, and Sage sorts the admin afterwards. Everything's sorted in the background so I don't spend hours doing it later. Magic.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience helping British businesses like Mike at Residual Electrical Contractors. That's more than artificial intelligence. That's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I want to talk this hour about protest in this country. And the announcement of the weekend from the Home Secretary, and by the way, the backdrop in my mind to all of this isn't just this past weekend. It's the wider question about protests. And it isn't just about the Gaza-Israel protests either. I mean, clearly, that seems to be what's prompted the change this weekend from the Home Secretary. But anyway, to the point of what she said, she's saying that she will grant the police new powers in law to impose some conditions on some repeat protests to, as she put it, close a gap in the law. She was talking about the frequency of protests potentially being a factor here and allowing people to go about their daily business without feeling that they are intimidated in some way. Now, over the weekend, nearly 500 people were arrested during demonstrations in support of the proscribed group Palestine Action in central London on Saturday. Now, again, important to remember that some of the people there were protesting against the proscription of that organisation, which isn't the same as saying, yay, Palestine Action, and holding banners in support of it. They're protesting against a government decision. So clearly that's not breaking the law. Others were deemed by police in the moment to be breaking the law, and those cases will be heard in court or one way or another. But this move, since the events of last week, would allow police forces to consider what the Home Secretary called the cumulative impact of protests, assessing previous activity as well as what might be about to happen. The limits that could be imposed include moving demonstrations to a different place or restricting the time that they can occur. Now, I think this is going to be difficult to enact, and it should be difficult to enact because, as the new leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski, was saying, one of the facets of protest, I mean, it should never be violence, obviously. It should never be anti-Semitism. It should never be anti-Muslim. It should never be anti-black, you know, of course. But one of the facets of protest, it seems to me, is persistence, i.e. repeat. And the repeat of the pro-Palestine protests is legitimate, isn't it? It's if people are prepared to come out, engage with the police to arrange to come out in those numbers, then it's legitimate. Now, you know what I think already about some elements, and I can't stress enough because a lot of you don't hear this bit when I say it. Some elements have let down those protests involving people who many had never protested before. They joined those protests because of the horror of what they were seeing on their televisions every night of Gazan civilian suffering. So I think this is going to be difficult to achieve. It's going to be difficult to police. And my sense about those particular protests over the last 2 years isn't that their frequency may have annoyed people. I'm sure it has annoyed people. But that's not illegal. My issue with them and why I wouldn't join them, and by the way, I could easily have joined them if I hadn't seen these elements as part of them, is the policing of them, not the frequency of them, not who they've annoyed, but the policing of them, of the worst excesses amongst them. Not the people who've just gone there to say, I stand against this, but the worst excesses. And I won't iterate again what the worst excesses are, because I think you know what I'm alluding to. And if you need me to, I will when we talk. But, you know, less of me and more of you on 0345 6060 973, the usual number. You can text 84850. Do you have some sympathy with what the government is trying to achieve here? Or do you think, as Zach Polanski was saying in his response, that it is an attempt to limit protest in a way that isn't democratic? 0345 6060 973. I'm joined by Nicola Thorpe, a broadcaster and activist. Good afternoon to you, Nicola.
Hi. Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me on.
What's your interpretation of these protests? You were down as an observer, reporter, essentially, at the weekend. And yeah. I know you've been to others as well, other types of protests, to observe how they are carried out. So what's your sense of this move by the Home Secretary?
I think it's really disappointing. I found Saturday, I was there independently, but I found it incredibly moving. Over 500 people getting arrested simply for holding a sign. It was quite difficult actually to get interviews with people because most of them were there for a silent protest.
I mean, what's on the sign matters, doesn't it?
So it does, of course. The one woman that I did interview was an 83-year-old Reverend Sue Parfitt, and she had a sign that read, I support Palestine action. I oppose genocide. I grieve my Jewish brothers and sisters. And halfway through that interview, the Metropolitan Police came and arrested her, obviously for the element of the sign that said that she supported Palestine action. Mm. The majority of people there, I know you yourself, Sheila, have categorised some protesters as teenagers stomping their feet. I understand that you're hopefully separating those individuals from the majority.
Always,
who
Nicola,
are,
always.
Yeah, it's so important, I think, not to raise the temperature on this, but to do the opposite. These were middle-aged and elderly people who were being dragged away by the police, sometimes six or seven police officers carrying them away, simply for their right to protest the fact that Palestine Action had been prescribed a terrorist organisation. I think it's really dangerous, actually, what the Home Secretary's doing at the moment is to conflate this idea, obviously, Starmer said on Friday as well, that the protests shouldn't go ahead. Now, specifically, these are protests about Palestine Action and the fact that the Israeli government had captured many people on the flotilla that was attempting to reach Gaza to bring aid to it. Now, the idea that